This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice, activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org. And now for the Old Mole.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground.
By the mole. Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Steve is our engineer today. It's Monday, October 30th, just one day before KBOO's biggest holiday of the entire year. We want to thank everyone who participated in the pledge drive over the last few weeks, especially those who contributed directly and dedicated their contribution to the Old Mole Variety Hour. We all appreciate your participation very much. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. On this program, we regularly challenge and expose the malfeasance of governments and expose the ideology of our leaders as class-biased distortions of reality. We attempt to bring into focus the possibility of another reality, one grounded in the principles of equity and justice for all peoples. Today on our program, Bill Resnick will be talking to Dean Baker, author of such books as The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer, and co-author of Globalization and Progressive Economic Policy, among others. Today, Bill and Dean will be discussing what positive effect, if any, might come if the Democrats should capture at least one of the houses of Congress. Larry Bolden, our fiction reviewer, is going to review a book by Alice McDermott entitled Child of My Heart. I'll be discussing and reading from an editorial by Slavoj Žižek on the cultural and ethical importance of atheism. Closing out today's program, Movie Mole's Jan Hawken and Brooke Jacobson will be discussing the new film Catch a Fire, another powerful drama of South Africa during the apartheid era, and what, if anything, new it contributes to the genre. But now here's Bill with Dean Baker.
Thanks, Tom. Dean Baker, welcome to KBOO. Are we having problem? Is he on the air? Is he? Dean, are you there? Well, comrades and who are listening, I think we're going to have to call him back, it appears. Perhaps Steve's our engineer today, we could... do we have any pre-recorded things? Or maybe Tom Becker, you could do your
Bill,
piece.
Bill, you are off the air. This is Tom again. We're going to reorganize the program a little this morning, and I'm going to proceed right into the piece I was intending to do. An interesting editorial appeared in the New York Times in March of 2006. The article was by cultural critic Slavoj Žižek. Žižek is one of the hottest cultural critics in the world today, especially in Britain and the U.S., where his writings are widely read and endlessly analyzed by leading intellectuals. Žižek, a Slovenian, is also particularly popular among Eastern European youth, as well as youth in the English-speaking world, because of his wordplay, language games, and his incessant irony, in which virtually every statement is a double entendre. Perhaps this was a necessary strategy to be an intellectual in the former Yugoslavia. But like many cultural critics, his prose is often impenetrable by the uninitiated. But the editorial I am about to read from is a model of clarity. Its title is Defenders of the Faith, but, ironically, its content is as much on the important contributions of atheism to culture and morality. But now let me read from Žižek, which addresses all these issues and more. For centuries, we have been told that without religion, we are no more than egotistic animals fighting for our share, our only morality, that of a pack of wolves. Only religion, it is said, can elevate us to a higher spiritual level. Today, with religion, when religion is emerging as the wellspring of murderous violence around the world, assurances that Christian or Muslim or Hindu fundamentalists are only abusing and perverting the noble spiritual messages of their creeds ring increasingly hollow. What about restoring the dignity of atheism, one of Europe's greatest legacies, and perhaps our only chance for peace? More than a century ago, in The Brothers Karamazov and other works, Dostoevsky warned against the dangers of godless moral nihilism, arguing in essence that if God doesn't exist, then everything is permitted. The French philosopher André Glucksmann even applied Dostoevsky's critique of godless nihilism to 9/11, as the title of his book, Dostoevsky in Manhattan, suggests. This argument couldn't have been more wrong. The lesson of today's terrorism is that if God exists, then everything, including blowing up thousands of innocent bystanders, is permitted, at least to those who claim to act directly on behalf of God, since clearly a direct link to God justifies the violation of any merely human constraints and considerations. Zizek doesn't mention how Christianity's own sordid history, such as the Inquisition and its more recent terrorist bombings of abortion clinics, and its historical anti-Semitism, to mention but a few. It also seems appropriate here to mention that atheism also has its history of intolerance, as in the former Soviet Republic. But back to Zizek. During the Seventh Crusade, led by St. Louis, Yves Le Breton reported how he once encountered an old woman who wandered down the street with a dish full of fire in her right hand and a bowl full of water in her left hand. Asked why she carried the two bowls, she answered that with the fire she would burn up paradise until nothing remained of it, and with the water she would put out the fires of hell until nothing remained of them. Because I want no one to do good in order to receive the reward of paradise or from fear of hell, but solely out of love of God. Today, this properly Christian ethical stance survives mostly in atheism. Fundamentalists do what they perceive as good deeds in order to fulfill God's will and earn salvation. Atheists do them simply because it is the right thing to do. Is this also not our most elementary experience of morality? When I do a good deed, I do so not with an eye toward gaining God's favor. I do it because if I did not, I could not look at myself in the mirror. A moral deed is by definition its own reward. David Hume made this point in a very poignant way when he wrote that the only way to show true respect for God is to act morally while ignoring God's existence. 2 years ago, Europeans were debating whether the preamble of the European Constitution should mention Christianity as a key component of the European legacy. As usual, a compromise was worked out, a reference in general terms to the religious inheritance of Europe. But where was modern Europe's most precious legacy, that of atheism? What makes modern Europe unique is that it is the first and only civilization in which atheism is a fully legitimate option, not an obstacle to any public post. Atheism is a European legacy worth fighting for, not least because it creates a safe public space for believers. Consider the debate that raged in Slovenia, my home country, as the constitutional controversy simmered. Should Muslims, mostly immigrant workers from old Yugoslav republics, be allowed to build a mosque? While conservatives oppose the mosque for cultural, political, and even architectural reasons, the liberal weekly journal Mladina was constantly outspoken in its support for the mosque, in keeping with its concern for the rights of those from other former Yugoslav republics. Not surprisingly, given its liberal attitudes, Mladina was also one of the few Slovenian publications to reprint the infamous caricatures of Mohammed. And conversely, those who displayed the greatest understanding for the violent Muslim protests those cartoons caused were also the ones who regularly expressed their concern for the fate of Christianity in Europe. These weird alliances confront Europe's Muslims with a difficult choice. The only political force that does not reduce them to second-class citizens and allows them the space to express their religious identity are the godless atheist liberals. While those closest to their religious social practice, their Christian mirror image, are their greatest political enemies. The paradox is that Muslims' only real allies are not those who first published the characters for shock value, but those who, in support of the idea of freedom of expression, reprinted them. While a true atheist has no need to boost his own stance by provoking believers with blasphemy, he also refuses to reduce the problem of the Muhammad characters to one of respect for others' beliefs. Respect for others' beliefs as the highest value can mean only one of two things. Either we treat the other in a patronizing way and avoid hurting them in order not to ruin their illusions, or we adopt the relativist stance of multiple regimes of truth, disqualifying as violent imposition any clear insistence on truth. What, however, about submitting Islam, together with all other religions, to a respectful, but for that reason no less ruthless, critical analysis? This, and only this, is the way to show a true respect for Muslims. That concludes the article in my piece for the day. Let's see if Bill has managed to get Dean Baker on the line.
Hi, thanks. Thanks, Tom. Dean, I hope we've got the right connection now.
I'm here.
Oh, good. Let's just start out as we were going to start out. Let me introduce Dean Baker. He got his credentials, I believe, in the Dismal Science as an economist. He now operates as co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He does a blog, Beat the Press. Is that?
That's right.
Does that qualify as a blog? Anyway, you find it on the cybersphere, Beat the Press. And is it your latest book, Social Security, The Phony Crisis?
No, the latest book is The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer, which actually is available as a free e-book at conservativenannystate.org. You can just download it.
Ah. An engaged intellectual. Let's talk about the Democrats, Dean Baker. The midterm elections are upon us, 8 days till Election Day. Votes are maybe counted. And the polls show the Democratic victories in the House, victories in the House and Senate, and maybe a landslide. What's your sense of how that occurred? Was it sort of good Democratic campaign really raising issues and fighting to build a, quote, mandate? Or are people just fed up with Bush?
Well, it's clearly the latter. I mean, the Democrats quite consciously ran a sort of low risk campaign. They haven't put much forward by way of a positive agenda either internationally. I mean, obviously the war is front and center, and there is no Democratic position on how they're going to deal with the war, except, you know, they're saying they're going to do something different than Bush. And domestically, you know, they certainly have been out front and center on many things. The one point I will make, though, that where they have stood out is that they have made a point of saying they want to change the Medicare prescription drug benefit, which I do think is important. And I think there will be a lot of pressure for them to follow through on that if they do take over one of the houses. Now, whether they get that through or not, is it vetoed, is it stopped in the Senate, you know, who knows. But I think there will be a lot of pressure on the Democrats to carry through with their plans to change the Medicare drug benefit.
Yeah. I was reading over the last couple of days some of the proposals, at least, that are coming out. It's not a full program, but they would also clearly try and raise the minimum wage modestly, right?
Absolutely. That's definitely,
you know,
a high item.
Repeal some of Bush's tax breaks. Repeal the really big oil, the most egregious sort of just giveaways. But do they talk about actually taxing the rich? Is that that's not even part of their...
They haven't run on that, and I guess there's two reasons. One is that obviously some of them don't want to be seen as raising taxes on the rich, but the other is, as a practical matter, obviously they're not going to, you know, Bush would veto that. It would be a shock, you know, if they were to propose taking back the tax cuts at this point, that he wouldn't veto it. Also, one other point to make, you know, again, being fair to the Dems, that, you know, they're coming in, let's say they do get control of one of the houses of Congress, it's 2007, these tax cuts are phased out they disappear as of 2010. That's the current law. So, you know, as much as I would say, you know, repeal them tomorrow if you could, as a practical matter, they are, you know, it's a question, it's almost in the Republicans' court that they're going to have to push through legislation that extends these tax cuts beyond 2010. Otherwise, they end in 2010.
Mm-hmm. You know, another thing one could, I mean, I'm critical of the Dems for not going further and actually trying to develop a real agenda and inspire people, but they also would gain oversight power if they won one of the houses. They could start holding hearings on just a slew of things, not just the Iraq War, but the energy giveaways, the Federal Communications Commission, a variety of other issues. The way the Pell Grants have been, money's been given to the banks rather than to students.
Yeah, I mean, there's an awful lot by way, you know, corruption that, you know, has been associated with the Bush administration over the last 6 years that has largely gone unchecked because, you know, the people in principle shouldn't be investigating them, have no interest in doing so. So if they control at least one house, then they'll have, you know, investigative powers, which they don't at present. And, you know, I don't doubt there's a lot of things they'll uncover.
One of the sort of the things that caused me a little disquiet is how much money they've been able to, even non-incumbent Democrats in the, whatever it is, the 30 or 40, maybe 25 races that are really up for grabs, they've been able to get a lot of money, much more than non-incumbents have ever gotten in the past. It appears that big money people even are sort of moving towards, at least some of the smart ones, are moving towards the Democrats, which means, of course, that the possibilities of any real reform are become much less.
Well, if the Democrats get in, and, you know, the leadership's very proud of this, they're getting a lot of corporate money, and, you know, if they get in, then clearly they're going to be, you know, indebted to the people who, you know, who gave them that money. So, you know, that's going to be a real constraint. I don't know. I guess it's not really a surprise to me because, you know, if you go back before the Republicans took control of of Congress in 94, most campaign contributions to Congress did go to Democrats because, you know, they were controlling things. So, you know, these are not ideological people at either end, neither the people of office nor the people who are giving the money. It's, you know, in effect, you know, a business transaction. So they're giving money to the people who they think can do them favors. And, you know, now that they think there's a strong likelihood that the Democrats will be in that position, they want to make sure that they've paid their dues. So, you know, they have the price of admission, and, you know, when they want something from them, they're going to be taken seriously. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm not happy about it, but it's just not a surprise to me. I sort of assumed that, you know, if they were in a position to take control of Congress, they would be getting a lot of money from corporate interest.
Mm-hmm. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick talking to Dean Baker, who has a really good blog. It's called Beat the Press. And your latest book, Dean, is again,
The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer.
Oh, good. Well, that's a, is that a manual for using?
I think
how to get a tax break on your, for your zip code. Well, that's true. They've got lawyers who help them. You don't even
this is a
lobbyist.
Manual for the rest of us to see what they've been doing.
Yeah, it's a huge machine. The rich don't even have to put in any effort anymore. The machine just keeps going and enriching them. It seems to me the Democrats have a, I mean, there is a huge opportunity, which they are very, very, very unlikely to seize. But I know that with determined movements, in fact, that something could really happen. If you were writing, if you were the policy person in the Democratic National Committee, which you wouldn't be, what are the kinds of things you could propose?
Well, one of the things I'd have front and center, I mentioned the Medicare proposal that you should have Medicare negotiate drug prices directly with the prescription drug industry. They would get comparable prices to what Canada gets, basically half, you know, maybe a little more than half of what people are paying now, which would make both the drugs much more affordable and also save the government money. So, I mean, it's really, to my mind, just kind of a no-brainer. So I would have that front and center. But beyond that, we have to start getting towards universal health care. We can't afford our health care system. It's broken. We pay more than twice as much per person as what they pay in Germany, England, France, Denmark, the other wealthy countries, all of whom have longer life expectancies than us. So we're throwing a lot of money in the garbage. And my step towards getting there is a very simple one. Why don't we just open up Medicare, let anyone who wants to, any individual or employer, buy into the Medicare system? I love throwing that one out there, and this is, you know, sort of a story in my conservative nanny state. I'm not going to give them rhetoric, give them their rhetoric. What I say is, what's wrong with giving people a choice? And the conservatives who don't want to let people buy into Medicare, well, they don't want to give people a choice. You know, we're not taking anything away from anyone. We just want to put one more choice on the table. Go, you know, if you'd rather waste money on a private insurer that, you know, rips you off and, you know, cheats you on the claims and everything, go ahead, please do. You know, but let's just give everyone in the country the option to buy into Medicare so they have the option of getting a good health care plan. And we could work from that. We could build on that to having a universal system modeled on Medicare. But, you know, from my mind, let's get a first step, which I've yet to find any conservative who has an argument. They just start yelling at you. But I've yet to hear anyone give me an argument as to why you can't do that.
Now, my understanding is that George Miller is, in fact, trying to – one of his programs, he would become head of the House, whatever committee that does it, health and something committee, is promoting the idea of placing all the uninsured on Medicare,
Different issues. One is to actually, you know, put people into it, which isn't necessarily a bad idea, but that costs money. If you just say, why don't we just let everyone buy into it, that doesn't cost anything because they're paying their way into it. And, you know, my guess is that very quickly you probably have most of the population signed up in Medicare because, you know, I'm thinking I'm an employer here. You know, we have about 15 people at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. If you gave us the option to buy in Medicare, we'd be there tomorrow.
And maybe so would the financial pressure. The incentives to do that would be enormous, wouldn't they?
Absolutely. You know, you'd almost certainly save money, and what's more, there'd be a little more predictability. I mean, our insurance company has been raising our rates by double-digit amounts every year for, you know, well, we've been in business 6 years, so pretty much every year. And, you know, that's a hit for us. It's going to be a hit for any business. So, you know, if we knew that, you know, we can get Medicare rates and they're going to go up more or less with the rate of, you know, healthcare inflation, which they themselves might be in a position to control, we'd be right there. So it's not an ideological thing, although I do think it's, you know, it is good. But, you know, apart from that, just, you know, purely on a business perspective, we'd be there in no time. It's a good deal.
Yeah. It seems to me they could also come up with a reasonable program for taxation that was fair, trade policies that
I could throw out lots of other things. Trade policy, one of the things, you know, a lot of the Democrats are really big. We have to have more NAFTA-type trade agreements. I know all these guys here, they're going, what would make you, you know, meaning sort of more progressive, labor-oriented Democrats go along with trade? You know, their trade agreements. And, you know, basically what they're willing to put on the table is everything that they know doesn't mean anything. But, you know, I like to flip this around. I go, you guys want free trade. I'm referring to my book here because this is something straight out of the conservative nanny state. You guys want to open up trade. Let's start at the top because what trade has been about thus far has been to put, you know, workers with less education, you know, our factory workers, you know, our less educated workers in direct competition with workers in the developing world. And we know, I mean, that's what economic theory tells us should happen is that drives down wages for those workers. That's the expected result. I have no idea what goes through these people's heads when they propose those policies, but the expected result of NAFTA and other trade policies like that is auto workers, you know, textile workers, manufacturing workers will get lower pay. So I say rather than, you know, focusing on trying to push down wages for those at the middle and bottom, let's do it for those at the top. Let's do it for doctors, lawyers, economists, accountants. Why don't we sign free trade agreements that put people like me in direct competition with people in the developing world? Because there's plenty of really bright people in Mexico and India and China who'd be delighted to work as doctors, lawyers, economists in the United States at a fraction of the wage that these people get today.
Well, that would show up their hypocrisy, but I'm not sure it would do very much for ordinary workers.
Oh, I'm sure it would, because it would lower the cost of health care, college education, and all the things in which these fees are embedded. So absolutely, it would do a lot for ordinary workers, and they should realize that, you know, because we get our ass kicked if we don't understand what's going on. The other side understands exactly what's going on. When they drive down the wages of auto workers, that means two things. To some extent, higher profits for the auto industry, but basically it means it's cheaper for everyone who's not everyone to buy a car. You know, so if you're not one of the people being put in competition, you benefit from having other people placed in competition with the developing world. We could flip that over and say, let's put the people on top in competition.
But
and absolutely, that would benefit factory workers, it would benefit custodians, dishwashers, on down the line, because they would get all those services at much lower rates.
But shouldn't we really be talking about a trade policy that sort of raises all boats around the world, that doesn't depress
That would raise all boats around the world. Because you would have gains to developing countries, because you'd have people suddenly getting much higher pay. You could have a portion of, you know, what they earn here remitted back to the countries to compensate them for the education. On top of that, of course, people themselves, you know, if you have someone from India becomes a doctor in the United States, they're going to send back money to help their family back at home, perhaps educate other people. So that exactly is a policy that lists all boats around the world.
Well, I'd be a little worried, though, that this unremitted competition on every conceivable product and service everywhere would have the impact of not only lowering prices for everything, but also lowering effective demand, where suddenly you wound up with sort of mass impoverishment and real international crisis.
Well, we already have that at the bottom end. So, I don't see any realistic prospect for reversing it. You know, so it would be great if we could talk about, you know, making things so that our auto workers didn't have to compete, but that's not going to happen. And so I just, you know, at this point, I don't feel, you know, it doesn't matter what I want to see in the world. We should talk about what could conceivably happen. So we're not going to be able to take our auto workers out of competition. So it seems to me what makes the most sense is let's put the people at top in competition, drive down the price of their services, and benefit people at the middle and bottom. Let's benefit the custodians, the retail clerks. Let them pay less for their health care, for their, you know, if they need a lawyer or all the things that lawyers' fees are embedded in. You know, we have to think like the other side does.
Although hiring a lawyer from, I'm not quite sure where, let's say Brazil or India, doesn't. In any event, Dean, let's not argue about this question. This is KBOO, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. You know, one other thing I think that the Dems could do, New Orleans, they're still sort of lavishing money on it, although going only to rich companies, of course, and Bush's friends. It seems to me that the reconstruction of the Gulf Coast offers just enormous opportunities for talking about what would be a very different kind of development pattern for large cities and even regions, and for the environment, and for jobs, and for sort of city planning. It seems to me one really could present very radically democratic sort of ideals and culturally rich and environmentally sustainable possibilities in the in programs around the reconstruction of New Orleans. Is there any possibility of the Democrats doing that?
Well, unfortunately, I haven't heard anything. I mean, you know, I would have been happy to see something as simple as a local hiring preference, because, you know, one of the big issues is that, you know, somewhere close to half the people who fled haven't come back, and, you know, they don't have homes there, and they don't have jobs there. And, you know, in some cases, they're bringing in other workers from elsewhere, you know, rather than bringing back the people who were there originally. And that wouldn't have been a hard thing to put in, that, you know, in any government contract, you know, direct or indirect, that, you know, they have to have a local hiring preference. They have to be able to say, we tried to hire locally and we couldn't hire anyone before they hired someone who wasn't from the area. So, that would have been very minimal. We didn't see that. I haven't seen the Democrats pushing for that. So, you know, it's unlikely.
They'll go any further. We only have a few more minutes, Dean. One thing we talked about yesterday, preparing for the interview, I mean, it seems to me if the Democrats even take one, the Senate or the House, they have tremendous opportunities, which they're very unlikely to, unfortunately. You know, there's so many conservative Democrats. It's not even clear that non-conservative Democrats would run the caucus in either of the houses, that the leadership could be, in fact, almost as conservative as the Republicans, just not as crazy. It seems to me that one of the great problems that the Democrats also, if they took power, particularly in 2008, there's a tremendous risk that they'd be they're of course far more capable of really radical domestic policy change than the Republicans. That is, they could really, quote, reform Social Security, whereas Bush got shot down in his efforts to give money to Wall Street. The Democrats, like Clinton, who ended welfare as we know it and passed NAFTA, two things that the Republicans could not have done. Clinton had to muzzle liberal Democrats and to muzzle the movements, the progressive movements, in order to get these things through, and very narrowly.
It seems to me a real problem.
The conservative Democrats could destroy Social Security and Medicare.
Well, that's a real danger. I mean, I think it's less likely in this period leading up to 2008, because my guess is that the Democrats wouldn't want to be seen as having done that prior to the 08 elections. But certainly if the Democrats retake the White House in 08, I think there's a very real possibility that, you know, Medicare, Social Security will be on the table. Going back to the Clinton presidency, you know, he twice wanted once cut and then the second time privatized Social Security. In 97, he was prepared to a deal with the Republicans in the Senate to cut the annual cost of living adjustment by 1% a year, which adds up. If you've been on Social Security for 15 or 20 years, you're talking about basically a 15 to 20% cut. So he was actually prepared to go along with that, and Dick Gephardt was the one who stopped him by threatening to, he refused to go along, and he was prepared to run against Al Gore in the 2000 primaries, and that was enough to get Clinton to back away. But that was what he was prepared to sign on to. And then again in 1998, Clinton was prepared to go ahead with a plan for privatization, but that was nixed by the Monica Lewinsky scandal when his presidency suddenly became in jeopardy. He had to turn to his core supporters, all of whom cared a great deal about Social Security. So he wasn't in a position at that point to be privatizing Social Security at the same time. He needed, you know, the women's groups, the labor movement, you know, the African-American groups, all of whom cared a great deal about Social Security. He couldn't then turn around and privatize while he was depending on them to save his presidency.
But in 2008, it seems to me, whoever, if a Democrat gains power, which is not unlikely, it seems to me the only way to stop that is really to build strong movements and to make it clear that that's unacceptable to them.
Absolutely. I mean, the realities are they would get huge, you know, hugely positive press. They'd win a lot of favor with the Wall Street people, as you were saying. If they could privatize Social Security, that would be such a big feather in their cap running for re-election.
That is so, with rich people.
And the whole big financial give a lot of money for campaigns.
Yeah.
And they all know that. They all know that. They're not morons. So they all understand that. So unless there's, you know, strong political pressure the other way, where people are prepared to say, you do that, you know, forget, we'll never vote for you again. We don't care who gets elected, you know. Unless there's really strong political pressure the other way, it's going to be hard for some one of these people to resist, looking to privatize Social Security.
Dean Baker, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Sure. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Right. So long.
Thanks, Bill and Dean. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. Now let's turn things over to Larry Bolden.
Good morning. I know that most of you passionate readers will understand when I say there are some books that are just too lovely to talk about. Just no way of getting at what they have to offer short of plunging into them, or in this case, licking them, savoring them. Alice McDermott's new novel, Child of My Heart, is just such a book, and I'm hoping to get you to pick it up by saying very little. If I could, I would dangle it like a sweet red lollipop in front of you, just as on the paperback version there is a tree strung with orange and red and yellow lollipops, the rare fruits of imagination. And who says you can't judge a book by its cover anyway? Certainly it was the cover of this little book that grabbed me, although it was the name of the author that cemented the purchase. I've been one of those readers fortunate enough to have large swatches of time laid out before me to read, sometimes whole summers full of nothing but sun and books. That means that when I find an author whom I really like, one that seems to be teaching me as well as enchanting me, I've often been able to read up their whole life's work in just a few days, a few weeks at most. I still find it a wonderful way to read. Not surprising, then, that just a few weeks ago I talked to you about one of McDermott's earlier novels, Charming Billy, and today I feel that I must tell you about this newer one. The setting is Long Island, sometime in the 90s, and the heroine is a 15-year-old girl who is the only child of aging Irish-American parents who did not have her until they were in their 40s. They move to Long Island to, in their minds, assure her future. Quoting from the book, "Being who they were, children of immigrants, well-read but undereducated, my parents saw my future only in terms of how I would marry, and they saw my opportunities narrowed by Jewish, Irish, Polish, Italian kids who swarmed the city and the close-in neighborhoods where they could afford to buy a home. They moved way out on Long Island because they knew rich people lived way out on Long Island, even if only for the summer months, and putting me in a place where I might be spotted by some of them was their equivalent of offering me every opportunity." Close quote. This urge to put their daughter, Teresa, in the paths of the rich also accounts at least partly for their not only allowing her to babysit for families from the time she's only 10 years old, but actively encouraging her to take on more and more charges as the summers roll by, to visit more and more of the big summer homes that her parents can only admire from afar. And Teresa is, from the beginning, a star at what she does. A beautiful, dark girl who is wise far beyond her years, but who is also strangely innocent and unworldly. Again, quoting from the book, "I must have fit right into the pretty summer dreams those pretty young mothers had back on Fifth Avenue in March. Pretty, intelligent, mature in speech, although undeveloped physically, another plus, well immersed in my parents' old-fashioned Irish Catholic manners, inherited from their parents, who had spent their careers in service to this very breed of American rich, and, best of all, beloved by children and pets. I don't know how to account for it, my way with small creatures, nor did it ever occur to me to try. Because I was a child myself when I began to take care of other children, I saw them from the start as only a part of my realm, and saw my ascendance as a simple matter of hierarchy. I was the oldest, if only by a year or two, among them, and as such, I would naturally be worshipped and glorified. I really thought no more of it than that. And when they clung to me and petted me, when the boys, lovesick, put their heads into my lap and the girls begged to wear my rings or comb my hair, I simply took it as my due. I was Titania among her fairies, and the dogs and cats and bunnies and gerbils that seemed to follow their young owners in their affection were only doing what nature in our little realm prescribed. If there was any trick, any knack to my success as a minder of children, it was, I suppose, the fact that I was as delighted with my charges as they were with me." Close quote. This entire little book is simply the unfolding of a few days in Teresa's life. For one family, she merely walks their dog, Red Rover, and occasionally tends their children on a weekend. For another, she comes by every morning to walk two Scotty dogs. Yet another family has her tending three cats while they're in the city and babysitting both their children and their cats on the weekends. And finally, she cares daily for a young girl, Flora, whose father is a famous old painter and whose mother, decades younger, feels imprisoned on Long Island and escapes often to the city. The insights Teresa has as she goes from house to house, child to child, animal to animal, are charming and yet somehow alarming in their profundity. Added to her paid duties, she also supplies daily care and attention for a handful of dirty kids who live next door and who love her, adore her, hang on her at every chance. The Pied Piper of Long Island, who finds it quite natural to be followed and adored. And finally, for the few days that this novel covers, a young girl cousin, Daisy May, joins Teresa on her daily rounds, invited by Teresa so that the shy and frail Daisy can escape for a time from the city, her seven siblings, and her overworked, cranky parents. I simply cannot describe how lovely the relationship is between Daisy and Teresa, two minds who can together spin magic out of the air. Slowly, the reader discovers, along with Teresa, that Daisy is quite ill. Bruises on her body that do not heal, a tiredness that will not go away even in the sun and sea breezes. I cannot but think that this novel is deeply autobiographical. The precociousness of Teresa, her deep understanding of her own parents and of all the adults around her, seems more remembered than made up. And despite her girlish thinness, she's well aware of the new looks she gets from older men, their unapologetic appraisal of her pretty face, her budding body. If anything, she's even calmer than they in her appraisal of their appraisal, already wiser than they. Interested in their attention, but not really alarmed, she realizes a power she has with them, understands more about them than they about her. She also understands on a deep level that she's already wiser than her parents, has already stepped away from their world, careful not to tell them more than they need to know, protecting them even as they see themselves as protecting her. As she listens through the thin walls of their little cottage to the calm, constant river of their voices, she understands that she is as much caregiver now as cared for. Whenever reviewers strive to find authors with whom to compare McDermott, the name Jane Austen invariably arises, and it's easy to see why. Her novels begin in very small worlds, usually in a family or two. More novels of families and customs than of worlds and wars. One reviewer talks of how beautifully written her novels are and how quietly unsettling. Yes, indeed, wrenchingly beautiful and unsettling due to their wisdom, the acuteness of the observing eye. I was in the middle of two other novels when I started this one. Those two remain unfinished. McDermott must be read. I've been talking about Alice McDermott's Child of My Heart. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Larry, for another interesting book review. Now in our studio are the movie moles Jan Hocken and Bruce Jacobson to discuss the film Catch a Fire, now playing in area cinemas.
Yes, I am eternal, so yet you go see.
Good morning. This is Jan Hocken, along with fellow movie mole Brooke Jacobson, talking this morning about Catch a Fire, a film playing, being distributed throughout the U.S. This week. Set in South Africa during the final decade of the anti-apartheid struggle, Catch a Fire, directed by the Australian Philip Noyce, tells the story of the political transformation of black South African Patrick Chamuso, played by Derek Luke. The film opens with Chamuso, foreman at an oil refinery, and his wife Precious, played by Bonnie Mabuli, driving home happily after a festive day with their family. Precious giggles as she learns to drive while Patrick finally takes control of the wheel. The massive refinery where Patrick works looms ominously in the background, but life is as good as it gets for this black family under apartheid. Patrick struggles to stay clear of confrontations with the bosses and to protect the modicum of comfort he and his wife have achieved. Patrick's position of relative prosperity under white rule, which requires submission to daily humiliations, collapses when Chamuso is arrested and tortured following a bombing attempt at the refinery. After his wife also is tortured by the Afrikaner security forces, headed by the calculatingly professional Nick Vos, played by Tim Robbins, Chamuso becomes radicalized. He leaves his family to join the ANC training camp in Mozambique and becomes a leading fighter in the armed resistance that contributed to the final collapse of apartheid. The film concludes with the moving return home of political prisoners from Robben Island after de Klerk cedes power. freedom fighters under the leadership of Nelson Mandela call for a politics of forgiveness from those personal betrayals and moral failures of the oppressed to the brutality of the white racist regime. Well, Brooke, how do you understand the particular contribution of this film to a whole series of films on South Africa and the anti-apartheid struggle, and particularly the character of Patrick Chamuso, who's lesser known than many of the other freedom fighters?
Yes, he is not well known, not a recognizable name that stands out to us from that struggle. And I think that that's significant about this film, is that it gives us some perspective on that struggle from a black South African, making him the hero. And in some ways, the fact that he's not a widely recognized figure, even though he is a hero and is recognized within South Africa, simply not internationally, it's unusual, because there have been so many films that we have seen dealing with South Africa and the struggle against apartheid that by and large focus on white people, like A Dry White Season, or even the film made earlier based on Sean Slovo's script, A World Apart, dealing with her parents and their role in that struggle.
And by the way, it's important to note that Sean Slovo wrote this screenplay as well.
Yes, that is important, and I think that we should talk about that. But anyway, so the film does focus on the moral awakening of this individual who is not suffering extraordinary oppression at the outset. He is quite well positioned, even though people around him are obviously being brutally oppressed, and he's seeing a good share of that.
And has achieved a bit of that security as part of a strategy of appeasement in the context of earlier several decades of struggle and resistance. You have both more brutality as the apartheid system cracks down, but also buying off a bit here and there with giving promotions to a few blacks within the apartheid system.
So it gives us a little insight of a new sort into the way and the long ordeal of that struggle against apartheid and the complexity of it. I think it's important the way the film focuses on the interaction, the strategies being used by the white security forces and Nick Voss, Tim Robbins' character, as this very manipulative individual who's using every bit of information he can gain about this man's personal life, trying various means. You know, the fact that he invites him to dinner with his family at one point, attempting to form a kind of bond with him, thinking he can bring him over to his side.
There's that good cop, bad cop routine that's very familiar when, and after being stripped of your humanity, one comes in and seems to offer you something. And he has mastered that skill, but you also don't have a psychological, it's not reduced to a kind of psychological set of motivations explainable through sadism. He has a kind of professional interest in, and also personal interest in protecting his family and feeling increasingly under siege. There are some scenes that seem quite funny in the context of the brutality of his job, where you have him picnicking and playing the guitar, some sort of South African version of Kumbaya with his family, this sort of bucolic scene, and you get these two sides of men who both have families they're trying to protect, but caught in the forces of history and locked into a tragic struggle where both, where everyone is brutalized and loses some degree of humanity. Although the moral failings of Patrick Chamuso, I think of his betrayal of his wife and the kind of small betrayals of daily life, as you're saying, the film draws out.
And her betrayal of him.
Yes.
In return.
So in a way, no one's innocent of betrayal, but that they're set against a much larger brutality and the way in which the betrayals of daily life and hurts between people among the oppressed are manipulated by the oppressor, I thought was quite effective.
And it's interesting the way this film is being received, because so much of the critical response and the reviewers' response has focused on terrorism and the idea that this film shows how a terrorist is created. But it's
because initially Patrick is innocent of the crime he's accused of, and he's tortured and then finally released when the security forces realize that he didn't do it. But then he's radicalized by the conditions of torture, and parallels with Guantanamo and the behavior of the U.S. throughout the world and its paranoid, relentless search for terrorists and creating the very conditions it seeks to control one of the moral lessons people are drawing from this film.
Yes, and so many people are saying, why this film at this time? You know, this is an old issue. We're done with apartheid, but apparently the filmmakers feel it does have actual relevance today. And looking at, you know, how does revolutionary struggle take place?
In that line of critique, the revolutionary struggle and terrorism also are collapsed so easily in the eyes of Western critics, because this would be a mistake, I think, Sean, those who are involved in the making of this film, to see this as, to accept that line of interpretation, that this was someone who came into consciousness in confronting the full force of the brutality of the regime that he couldn't protect himself from, and became a disciplined member of the military wing of the ANC, and which was cast as terrorists. But that's certainly not how those in the struggle cast themselves. In fact, the film, I suppose, could be criticized as being too exonerating or romanticizing the ANC a bit.
It looks at a point at which a part of the strategy was to make the country ungovernable by sabotage. The difference between sabotage and terrorism, I think, is a fine line to draw. But it's clear that the target in this film is not what we think of today as terrorism.
Well, they planned and succeeded in blowing up this enormous power plant, and then the question is, and when you confront the seat of power, what is the collateral damage? And perhaps that's another film. But this is certainly worth seeing. It's a quite compelling film. Once again, this is Jan Hawken, Brooke Jacobson, reviewing today Catch a Fire, playing in theaters throughout Portland.
Africa, mago benjalo, mago benjalo, muse kubenguna pagate, muse kubenguna pagate.
Thank you, Jan and Brooke. As a final thought for today, I urge all KBOO listeners who haven't yet done so to read the lead article in yesterday's Oregonian. It seems that gasoline here in the Northwest contains the highest concentrations of the cancer-causing compound benzene than anywhere else in the nation. Now, this would seem an issue to really get organized around. One final announcement. there is a rally, a Joe Keating for governor rally tonight, the Pacific Green candidate. It is at the Crystal Ballroom, at the Lola's Room in the Crystal Ballroom. Starts at 7 p.m., a suggested donation, $5 or up. There will be three bands to enjoy: the New Old Timers Bluegrass Band, Jim Hind, Seattle Troubadour, and the Stumptown Jug Thumpers. That concludes our program for today. I'm Tom Becker. Steve has been our engineer. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM in Hood River, the Dalles, and the Gorge, and 100.7 FM in Corvallis and Albany. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 10, we hear a special program for the election season. Becca Bartleson will discuss election integrity as it relates to Oregon with members of the Oregon Voter Rights Coalition and others. At 10:30 on Earthwatch, Chris Andre speaks with Dan Ceres of Friends of Oregon Living Waters, who will update listeners on some of the recent LNG developments. And at 11, Democracy Now! Features a report from Oaxaca, where federal troops do not have control of the city. Also, a look at the life of indie media journalist and activist Brad Will, who was killed in Osaka. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Genesis Juice, producing organic fruit and vegetable juices in preserved in glass, including ginger lemonade, apple ginger, herbal fruit tonics, and more. Information and where to buy at genesisjuicecorp.com. And now for Becca Bartleson.
With the 2006 midterm elections fast approaching, many Oregonians are concerned with voting irregularities nationwide. Oregon has a vote-by-mail system, automatically leaving a paper trail many states do not have. Is Oregon's election system safe? Casey Hansen, Executive Director of the Oregon Voter Rights Coalition, Oregon VRC, comments.
While the election process itself should not be an issue, it has become an issue. It's the only tool by which, folks can see their objective political issues realized. And if the election system's corrupted, neither candidates will be elected fairly nor initiative issues. So
I spoke with John Kaufman, the Multnomah County Elections Director. He explained how Oregon ballots are tallied.
Well, our counting is done in a central count process. We don't have polling places, so we don't have precinct machines that... electronic devices like touchscreens. We do not have them in Oregon. The ballot counters were purchased from Election Systems and Software, ES&S.
Again, Casey Hansen.
Most U.S. elections are run on three primary systems, Diebold, ES&S, and Sequoia. In the state of Oregon, it's all optical scanners, and all the machines are either ES&S or Sequoia. Problematically, all of these machines are still run on software that is trade secret. So neither election officials nor the public has access to these codes.
Well, there's several concerns.
Jerry Adams of the Oregon VRC.
One is that the Arosovich brothers are executives in what one's with ES&S and one's with Diebold. And Diebold and ES&S do the majority of the counting of votes in the United States. You may have heard there was a big thing in Ohio where one of the executives of, I believe it was Diebold, was a leading contributor to one of the political parties and said they would deliver that political party. And so this is a company that's counting our votes in Ohio, said that they could deliver the votes for this candidate. And they did. I mean, the votes did not were not consistent with exit polls and other information, and that candidate did win that state. So that's one of them. Another is that a person by the name of Chuck Hagel, who is a senator, was the chief executive officer of ES&S in 1996. Before he became senator, he succeeded in getting the state of Nebraska to adopt his machines as the machines for all the votes throughout the state. He then resigned as CEO, and a few months later ran for Senate. And in one of the most miraculous turnarounds in history, even though he was way behind in the polls, he won. So those are some of the little clues that ES&S may not be the most reliable or flawless machines on Earth with that. The other thing is that ES&S will not allow anyone to see how the software counts the votes. Now, Diebold also makes the software for ATM machines, you know, where you get your money out. Now, that's open source. That means that the bank gets to see exactly how the software does its work. You would think with money, that's about as secure as you can get. So, obviously, it isn't a security issue that you let your client know how the software works. And what it's basically doing is simply counting. Supposedly, it's just counting. So why will they not let anyone on Earth see how the software counts? That is, they won't let anyone see the programming that causes the software to count. So our concern isn't with our officials. We've talked to many of our officials. Our Secretary of State is extremely good. Multnomah County is extremely good. Many of the other counties that we've worked with are extremely good. They have high security. They do everything right, except that all the counting, the final thing, is done through ES&S software.
And the primary this past year?
John Gideon of Vote Trust USA.
ES&S had problems across the country with their ballot programming. They do ballot programming for a good number of their clients. ES&S does all of the ballot programming. If a county wants to do their own, they have to buy the software that costs like $30,000 just to buy the software, and then there's licensing fees after that. They also print ballots, and their printers have also failed with poor workmanship on the ballots, and they failed to get ballots out in a timely manner so that they could be mailed out for absentee ballots and so forth. And just reading this morning, Summit County, Ohio, is in that position now. Their ballot programming, they got their ballots in. The second page of the ballot is all garbage, run together words and so forth. So this should be of concern to all states and all that use ES&S products.
Optical scan machines are used to count Oregon's ballots. Again, John Kaufman on the process.
We do our own programming. We create our own test decks to make sure that the program that we develop for a given election is counting correctly. The ballot counters are not networked. There is no wireless capability with these machines. They are not connected via modem to anything, so they are purely standalone devices that exist within our secure ballot counting room.
But are these machines safe? John Washburn is an independent technical expert who works with Vote Trust USA.
It does make them safer, but but you have to understand, safer is not the same as safe. The analogy I like to use is the stern of the Titanic was the best place to be on the ship, but it wasn't a good place to be. And just because it's safer doesn't make it safe. But yes, it does make them safer because it cuts down on one whole line of access from which you could do manipulations. Yeah, essentially, if it's not networked and it's not internet capable, then you have to physically get in touch with have to have physical access to the machinery to do anything to it, or at least physical access to its memory components, as was the case in with the Diebold scanners. As long as I can swap out a card, I can make the optical scanner pretty much say anything I want.
Ballot definition programming is one of the main concerns with Oregon voting activists. Kathy Jackson of the Oregon VRC.
What I know about the architecture of ESNS op scan machines is that there is a there is a chip called an EEPROM chip that is programmed every time there is an election. There is a new chip put into the optical scan machines that is uncertified and untested, and it's a brand new chip that interacts dynamically between the ballot definition files and the counting algorithm in the software, and nobody knows how that works or if there could be any problems that creep in every time it's created, every time there's a new election. Our elections in Multnomah County are being programmed in Omaha. They laid out, sort of like you lay out on your word processor, what goes where. But the actual programming, the coding part of it, is done in Omaha.
John Washburn.
It goes through an optical scanner, which recognizes a pattern of marks. The term mark sense ballot. So what the mark sense ballot then, what the scanner is doing is it's recognizing these patterns of marks, whether it's for write-in, like candidate, and the ballot definition file or ballot definition programming, depends who you talk to, which term they use, is what translates that pattern of mark to a set of votes for various candidates in question. And then the question is who does this ballot definition or ballot definition programming? And that varies across the country. For ESNS equipment, almost all jurisdictions, ESNS does the programming, except for a few of the larger ones where they bought some additional software and then they do it themselves and essentially recompile a new executable for each election on their own. Otherwise, it's something ESNS charges for on an ongoing basis. I do know that according to Paul Kraft and Steve Freeman, who are two-thirds of the technical subcommittee of the National Association for State Election Directors, and just a little background, NASED, National Association of State Election Directors, is the current sponsoring organization for what the testing is done at the national level. And essentially they contract that out to these labs called the Independent Test Authorities. Well, Paul Kraft, Steve Freeman, and Britton Williams are the three people from the NASED group that review the work from the ITAs to see if they've done everything they claim they've done. Well, it came to light in California earlier this year that according to Paul Kraft and Steve Freeman, there is no way for an election official to confirm or deny that the election software actually running on his machine at the time of an election is the state-certified version. Essentially, ESNS equipment creates a new executable for every single election that's brand new and never been reviewed for every election. The only reason that I even know about this statement by Mr. Kraft is he told it to a California state election official, and that email was later provided as part of a open records request. Otherwise, that would have never been made public. Nobody knows because no one's been able to do any independent investigation. The NASED ITA testing model is identical to the research model of the Tobacco Institute from the 1970s. The vendors pay for all the testing. If they don't like the results, they don't get published. And if, you know, it's like the Tobacco Institute research on the effects of smoking. As long as it's good for tobacco, we'll publish it. If it's not, it just quietly disappears and never gets seen again. The same with the NASED ITAs. If the report's bad, it never gets published. If it's good, well, then, of course, vendors are more than happy to publish it to select people. But if the public asks for it, well, then you can't look at it because that's a trade secret. the very evidence that these pieces of machinery are merchantable and fit for use is claimed to be a trade secret by the vendors. And that's both, that's Diebold, ESNS, Sequoia, Hart, all of them. They say that the reports that attest to the fact and give evidence that they're merchantable and fit for use to administer elections is a trade secret and not available to the public.
Some Oregon counties do conduct tests for accuracy. According to Jerry Adams, these tests still leave room for irregularities and maybe even election fraud.
Well, Multnomah County and I believe most, if not all, counties in Oregon do what's called a logic and accuracy test. And a way that that is performed, for example, is they will hand tally, or they will hand score, like 1,000 ballots, and then they will run them through and see if the counting by the machine is the same as what they intended. And that's what's called a logic and accuracy test. And that's done before and sometimes during and after the election. Now, you would think, well, if it counts 1,000 votes correctly, then you've got it. How could it be wrong? How can a machine count for a period correctly and then not? Well, no one at the federal, state, or local level can see the script, the programming. So it would be very easy, and we think this is what's happened, not necessarily in Oregon, is that there is programming that says after 5,000 ballots, then flip a certain percentage of votes for one candidate to the other candidate. And that would not be picked up in a logic and accuracy test. And there is no way that one would know unless you did a random sample of the paper, and then there would be a clear discrepancy between the paper count, the hand count, and the machine count. Now, Oregon has in the past used what they call an audit, which was for 2% of precincts, they would count all of the ballots and see if counting all of the ballots in those 2% matched. And that's what's called cluster sampling. But basically, that would not catch this. What would catch it is sampling a small percentage of all of the precincts. Then you can do it. This other way, you can't catch it.
Well, Oregon has always had the ability for candidates or measure people to request a recount.
John Kaufman.
And the recounts are done by hand. Oregon also has a law that says that any time in any contest the margin is less than 1/5 of 1% of the total votes cast, there is an automatic recount.
Even a small percentage of Oregon's ballots being counted by hand would help verify the result obtained by machine. Again, Casey Hansen.
Oddly enough, in some jurisdictions, while it's not mandatory, some of our county officials voluntarily do that kind of thing. Interestingly, recounts while not being required by the state, it can be conducted by administrative fiat directed by the Secretary of State. That would be done in close elections, but what we recommend is the verification be conducted for every election. And 40,000 votes statewide, once again, that's a very rough number, would not be much in some areas, but would be able to verify whether there was something going wrong with their system or not. As it stands right now, you can't tell. I mean, even the Brennan Center report came out and said that, you know, while the voter-verified paper trails, i.e. paper ballots or, you know, paper reproductions produced by machines, if they're not backed up by a routine random audit, they're, you know, only good for instilling a false sense of security. You know, an actual verification process done, you know, would verify an election and should not only should give citizens a sense of security, but it would obtain the objective of a fair election.
Our goal is to have a scientifically sampled, hand-counted, randomly sampled verification of the actual ballots so that we can make sure that we answer the most important question on every election is who really won.
Kathy Jackson, Oregon VRC.
And if we can verify to a scientifically stringent level of, say, 99% level of confidence. If we can verify to that level, then we're going to be sure, relatively sure, that the machine reported tally is absolutely correct. And then we'll have an early warning system in case something is dreadfully wrong.
Once again, you know, we think there should be improvements, but overall, Oregon gets a pretty good grade.
Casey Hansen.
There's just some things that we need to improve in the system to absolutely, you know, secure an A-plus for Oregon instead of a B in terms of, you know, election integrity. Private corporations have no business coming between a citizen and a citizen's vote. And it's absolutely essential that citizens regain not the oversight of the election process in every respect.
Voter fraud has attracted a lot of attention as politicians grapple with immigration issues in an election year. But is voter fraud really a problem? Again, Casey Hansen.
This is a big, giant red herring. That it's a diversion method. When the issue becomes voter fraud, folks forget that the real issue is election fraud. And let's set a different paradigm here. ID is required for most things in life as an American citizen. So we're used to the idea of ID. We need an ID to drive. We need ID to cash a check. Let's bear in mind all these things are privileges. Voting is a right. It's a different dynamic entirely. If voter fraud is to occur, it has to be a compelling case for any state to pass a law or for the federal government to pass a law. There's not a compelling reason there. To say, oh, this may happen, isn't legitimate. In fact, the case that just came down in Missouri verified just that. Last week, the Supreme Court of Missouri upheld in a lower court decision that said that essentially the appellants did not present a compelling case to prove that there was voter fraud at all. And indeed, that the institution of such a strict voter ID law, which Missouri had just passed in the 2006 session, would serve to disenfranchise a large number of voters. It unfairly would put essentially a poll tax on the poor minority communities and present a blockage to civil rights.
Kathy Jackson.
There is a new report that has been produced by the Election Assistance Commission. It's a federal agency that was created under the Help America Vote Act, that is also called HAVA, in 2002. And they just produced a report on the subject of voter fraud, you know, whether people are voting fraudulently, people who are not, who are either not registered or who are not qualified to vote for some reason. And they scoured the country looking for it, and they found no evidence of widespread voter fraud. That's different from election fraud. Voter fraud is an individual voter in a polling place or mailing in a ballot that they are not entitled to vote. They found, a couple cases in West Virginia, something in scattered around the country, but they were just kind of here and there. There's no evidence. They looked for it, and because they couldn't find it, this Election Assistance Commission report has been unreleased. They just suppress the evidence, and so this report has been unreleased, but it was published in USA Today. And they looked really hard, couldn't find anything. In Oregon, Secretary of State office says that over the past 15 years, they have found that they have about 10 complaints of people who shouldn't be voting. Of those, 2 were prosecuted. Those were not illegal people, illegal aliens. They happened to be legal residents who did cast a ballot and shouldn't have. That's not
evidence of a horde of people voting illegally. Knowing how the requirements are for registering to vote, knowing the requirements for filling out the forms, and that it is a felony to register and vote illegally, I cannot imagine how you would have hordes of illegal aliens wanting to put their name in a government document, in a government database where they could be found with their street address and all their identifying information. And they have to remember, in Oregon, they have to do this at least 20 days before the election. So that would be plenty of time, if this were a question, for the INS to get a hold of this public record information and go looking for illegal people who might be registered to vote. So I can't imagine that that this is a problem, and the EAC report clearly demonstrates that it is not.
If you are interested in becoming involved with election integrity issues, the Oregon VRC has several ways by which you can become involved. Again, Jerry Adams.
We would want them to write the editor of the Oregonian and their local newspapers that they do want independent verification of the outcomes of races, that they can tell their local state legislators that they want this. And that actually makes a difference. We have heard that when citizens tell their county elections office, their county clerk, county board of elections, the county commissioners, those are kinds of people who actually listen. And if you tell them that you want it, I think there is a good chance that they would respond. We would encourage people to go to observe. We would encourage them to video, if they can, as part of solidarity nationally. And what we intend this time is, unlike any election in history, and we believe this will happen, there will be a massive amount of videotaping of the elections process. And instead of hearing about it, then someone sues, and then it goes on, and then that doesn't have any effect on the races. This time, we are going to be involved with nationally live catching the incidents, the irregularities, the problems, and immediately working with legal to turn it around, to stop it. So in other words, instead of someone doing something wrong and then we sue them, this time we're going to stop them if we can. First time ever. The other thing that we're asking people to do is actually go to the county elections offices and do a vigil because of national solidarity. And we think this will be the first time for this also all over the nation. And to intend to stay. So this is going to be different also nationally. All kinds of groups. We're working with Move On and People for the American Way and, you know, all the activist groups, basically, pretty much, to do a no-confidence vigil for the areas where they've totally violated the election laws and basically all of our rights by carrying on the election in a really corrupt fashion. So we intend to catch it this time, and we intend to protest this time, and we intend to stop it this time.
One of the main projects the Oregon VRC is currently organizing is Project OPEN. Kathy Jackson explains.
OPEN stands for Oregonians Poll Watching Elections Now, and during this current election cycle, we are inviting people to come into the polls and watch how things are done in Oregon elections. We think that it's very important for citizens to have oversight in the process and to know exactly what is happening, have a sense of how much security there is or isn't in the polling place, how careful our officials are in handling things behind the scenes. There is still time to sign up and have an opportunity to participate in poll watching. You can go to our website, and the contact information is there. Our website is www.oregonvrc.org. There's ways to get involved, and there's ways to keep up on what is going on, and our website and our email list is one way to do it.
For KBOO Community Radio, I'm Becca Bartleson.
This is the KBOO Community Calendar for Monday, October 30th. Today you can join Portland Center Stage for a panel discussion exploring parallel themes in current and upcoming works by PCS, Readers Theater Repertory, and the Inside Out Theater Collective. The panel will discuss and engage the audience in issues of identity, the artist and civic responsibility, and the ethics of loyalty, as well as corollaries between the rising tide of fascism in the early 20th century and the specious currency of civil liberties in contemporary society. The event is free and open to the public, and refreshments will be served. It's from 6 to 8 p.m. and is located in the Studio Girding Theater at the Armory on 128 Northwest 11th Avenue. For more information, call Tim DeRoach at 503-445-3794. For a little fun today, you can go to the Multnomah County Library Midland Branch for a free Day of the Dead and Halloween activity night. You can see an exposition of altars and join in games and other fun accompanied by Mexican folk music. Wear a costume and join the costume parade. The event is from 5:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. and is located at the Multnomah County Library on 805 Southeast 122nd Avenue in Portland. For more information, contact 503-988-5392. You can come to the OMSI Science Pub today for a free discussion on the origins of life on Earth with Dr. Niles Lemon, professor of chemistry at Portland State University. Dr. Lemon will explore problems in studying the origins of life and will tell about some insights and advances towards solving the puzzle of the beginning of life on Earth. The discussion begins at 7 p.m. and is located at the Bridgeport Brew Pub and Bakery on 1313 Northwest Marshall in Portland. For more information, contact sciencepub at omsi.edu or visit www.omsi.edu. If you want to enhance your personal connection to the community and nature, you can join the weekly Naturalist Skills Community Night by Cascadia Wild today. At Naturalist Skills Community Night, folks get together and learn some aspects of fire, water, shelter, food, tracking, bird language, and more. These gatherings give everyone an opportunity to meet folks, learn stuff, and have a lot of fun. Everyone is welcome. The event is from 7 to 9 p.m. For more information, visit www.cascadiawild.org or call 503-235-9533. You have been listening to the KBOO Community Calendar for Monday, October 30th, 2006. This is KBOO Portland.
You okay? Good morning. This is Chris Andre. I'm sitting in for Scott Forrester on Monday on the environment. You're listening to your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM, right here in Portland, Oregon. All homegrown, handmade, free-range, organic radio made by people like you that called up recently and were kind enough to become members or increase your membership. We want to especially thank you. This morning, we're joined by Dan Saris, and we're going to continue the series that that we've been working on here on liquefied natural gas facilities, to the possibility of a terminal being located right on the Columbia River, very close, actually, to Astoria. For that matter, wherever it is, another one's been being discussed for Coos Bay. But wherever these things rear their ugly heads, that's where we, people like you, people like me, people like Dan, who really care about our environment, that's where we need to be. One thing I heard this morning on the radio in Washington, they are building, I believe, the largest biodiesel manufacturing plant in the nation. That's going at Gray's Point, I believe. And I thought, oh, the irony. Here we're going to have this LNG plant right on the Columbia River. They're going to have to dredge the river so they can get the tankers up up there. They're going to have turning basins. That's going to need to be dredged. The possibility even after dredging the river for an accident, is very, very real. And the companies that are bringing this disaster to our front door are far, far away and will be very minimally inconvenienced should something go haywire with this. This morning I'm going to ask Dan a little bit about the developers, the companies behind this, private interest behind this, as well as the public sector, namely the Federal Energy Regulation Commission, because I believe that there's a hand-in-glove relationship there. Dan, can you... I think I've in the past said the name of your group incorrectly. How about correcting me on the air?
Sure. I'm with Friends of Living Oregon Waters, FLO, and I'm also with the Columbia River Clean Energy Coalition. I'm the staff person for that coalition.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, and that coalition is much broader than just FLO. It's Columbia Riverkeeper. It's landowners who are affected by the send-out pipelines, and it's a whole host of environmental organizations on the Lower Columbia.
So tell us a little bit about the developers behind this and about the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Well, I'll begin with the fastest moving proposal, and that's Northern Star Natural Gas, and that's at Bradwood Landing, which is about 30 miles up the river from the mouth of the Columbia. And Northern Star Natural Gas is a wholly owned subsidiary of Northern Star Holdings, which is owned by Matlin Patterson, and they are funding it out of New York. They're a Manhattan, essentially a junk bonder, basically out of New York. And they put up a bunch of very speculative money that is driving this project. And so it was interesting when they got their millions of dollars of funding from Matlin Patterson. It was more, to us, an indication of the weakness of the proposal than the strength of it, because this isn't Chevron or Texaco or someone with billions of dollars of backing. This is a speculative venture, and the backers are sort of follow right in line with the speculative nature of the project.
And where are we now with the Bradwood project?
They have filed an application with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and that application is on hold currently because the developer has done such a poor job, essentially, of filing its paperwork on time and with the completeness and accuracy that's necessary. So it's kind of surprising that FERC, an agency that the Federal Energy Rubber Stamp Commission, as we call it, they really tend to approve everything, has held this up. And a lot of it has been due to the Coast Guard being concerned with lack of information coming out of Northern Star and some other reports that just haven't been forthcoming. And so we hear now from Northern Star that, you know, that the process is moving along and we should be seeing a expedited timeline here pretty soon. But so far, it's been unimpressive.
And there are more, too, aren't there? There's one at Tansy Point.
That's right.
And there's Coos Bay. So they've got a number of these projects. It's not all the same developer, though, is it?
No, it isn't. It isn't. That's one of the interesting elements of what's going on in Oregon. For some reason, Oregon has become the recipient of five of these proposals. The second fastest moving proposal is in Jordan Cove, which is in North Bend. And that's an extremely unpopular proposal, which is surprising when a lot of people find that out. They think, well, Coos Bay would need the jobs, would want it. I was just there. There was a group of 200 people in a room. We had an open forum, and people there are extremely opposed and are asking for a vote on this. And, you know, they probably won't get it, but that's just another one of the proposals. There's a Calpine proposal right at the mouth of the Columbia in Astoria. Yeah. And that proposal was held up by a land use appeal that was filed by Columbia Riverkeeper and another group in Astoria, People for Responsible Prosperity. And Calpine has gone bankrupt. So that's certainly, you know,
it's
puts
indicative
that proposal in
of some sort of incompetence, dare I say.
Yeah, I think it absolutely is. I think that Calpine going bankrupt sort of while all these land use challenges were going through shows, again, that, you know, what's happening with the energy industry is they're throwing a bunch of proposals kind of up against the Columbia and up against our coastline and seeing what sticks. And that is, that's a process, and that's unfair for people who live there. They are put in a position of fending for themselves, and so we're trying to unite all these different proposals in places and present a unified front.
It's like trying to fight a number of little wildfires all over the place as it stands right now. It seems that way. Speaking of which, the Bradwood one, I was this morning was looking with a fellow who has a great deal of experience with ships and navigating and has worked on tankers, and he got out charts of the Columbia River, and we looked at the Bradwood site and figured out exactly where the turning basin would be, and we looked at the depths of the water and all that sort of thing. And he actually pointed out, he said, you know, if it did blow up, there's nobody around. It's a very sparsely populated area. I said, well, there are so many other aspects to these kinds of projects that are incredibly invasive and terribly damaging to the environment. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the first thing I would say is that there are people around. There are people who live extremely close to Bradwood on the Washington side of the river. The Oregon side is pretty sparsely populated, but on the Washington side, it's very, very I mean, there's a whole line of homes that are within half mile of where those tankers will be. I mean, they'll be able to throw rocks from their beach and hit those tankers when they're turning around, practically. I mean,
but no, they won't. There'll be a security zone.
Presumably, that's under consideration by the Coast Guard, and you know that's all secure information, so we can't get at it. But you're right. I mean, I think the environmental impacts of this are really, really severe. And that turning basin, I think you hit it right on the head. That's a major concern. It's 58 acres. It's over 700,000 cubic yards of material that's going to be dredged out of critical salmon habitat.
Well, I've got a question for you on that. How is it that they are allowed to dredge there? Because there's been a great deal of debate about dredging shipping channels further up the Columbia River near Portland. You know, the Port of Portland is very keen for the dredging to go full steam ahead so that larger ships can come up the river. But there have been all sorts of permitting issues and all kinds of environmental impact statements and all that kind of thing. How is it that they seem to be taking it for granted that they're going to be allowed to dredge there? How does that work?
I think that's a great question, and that's really one of the critical issues. The upper river tribes are very concerned with this. Fishermen are concerned with this. Obviously, the environmental community is concerned with this. People who live nearby I think the dredging is one of the critical aspects of this proposal that makes it really not viable. It's 58 acres, 700,000 cubic meters in critical salmon habitat, which is, like you've said, people have been wrestling over salmon habitat, fish counts, and access to fisheries for so long, and so many of the parts of the river. It just boggles the mind that this out-of-state sort of speculative, you know, Texas group could come in and dig a big hole in one of the critical rearing and spawning and migration habitats in the lower Columbia estuary. I mean, the estuary is held up as kind of the last bastion of good, you know, rearing and migration habitat. And that's so critical to the health of all the salmon that run up the river. And Northern Star just released a biological assessment, which is available on the FERC website, which is FERC.gov. You can sort of search there for Northern Star. And they admitted that they will adversely impact several salmon species, including lower Columbia Chinook, Willamette River Chinook, Snake River Chinook, those are fall Chinook, lower Columbia Chum, Steelhead, and those are just the ones they've admitted. And there's a whole host of other species and various runs that use that habitat. They say they won't impact, which we disagree with. We think they absolutely will.
I don't see how it could fail to impact.
I mean, those are fish that they expect they may actually kill during the construction and dredging activities themselves, without even really taking into account the long-term remodeling of that part of the river, which is absolutely crucial. And I think that for us is just an absolutely critical issue.
But it seems, though, that it was taken for granted that the dredging would go ahead, whereas the Port of Portland, it was an issue of considerable public debate. And here, within the case of Bradwood, it seems to be a done deal. I don't understand that.
I don't think it. I think that it. Bradwood would like to make it seem as though it's a done deal, and they've said publicly that they're almost through the permitting process. It's so inaccurate. It's almost false advertising. It's absurd. They've only just begun this process. They've just released a biological assessment, which is, I think, inadequate. But even that shows that they're going to adversely impact these species. And what they would want to do is throw a bunch of money into mitigation and enhancement in other areas of the river. Now, the assessment doesn't include the specifics of where that will occur, how it will occur, how it will enhance the specific runs that they're adversely impacting right there at Bradwood. So, I mean, it's almost laughably inadequate at this point in what they're planning to do. And I don't think it's a done deal, and I think it's absolutely where the state has authority to say, no, this doesn't meet our water quality standards under the Clean Water Act.
That gets into some other issues, too, eminent domain being one of them. The other thing I was looking at on the FERC website was the security zone that is going to have to be around these tankers when they come up the river. It's an enormous area of the river that has to be cleared. That means cleared of, correct me if I'm wrong here, the river has to be cleared of sport fishermen, commercial fishermen, people out just goofing around in sailboats or whatever, everything out of the river, everybody out of the water, right?
That's right. I think this is another critical issue.
Talk about what size are these zones?
Well, they vary.
Just imagine a 900-foot tanker is coming up the Columbia River.
Right.
What has to happen?
What happens in other places, for instance, Boston Harbor, they shut down traffic 2 miles ahead, 1 mile behind, and 500 to 1,000 yards to each side of the vessel. That's the entire Columbia River Channel.
And that would be for virtually the whole day, right?
Well,
how long does it take? These things are enormous.
They move they're moving 5 knots pretty slowly, we would hope. They would move slowly up the river. And if they're coming, they're barreling up the river. No boats can get out of the way, but the problem is that there's a lot of shallow water in the Columbia, and if other boats are in the river and have to take refuge, that there's two things that happen. One, it increases safety hazards, and two, it increases the delays to people who are fishing on the river, who are using it recreationally, and who use it for shipping. And shipping is
barges. I was going to ask about that. What are barges are not that maneuverable. Once they start going, they pretty much. It's not easy you don't just pull over and stop.
I can't claim to be an expert on shipping on the Columbia River, but I know that there are billions of dollars of wheat and other commodities that move up and down the Columbia River. And the idea that you would delay any of these ships for even a small amount of time, or in the case that God forbid, there would be some kind of maritime terrorist attack somewhere and security around these vessels was increased, then you're looking at a major impact because they're what's called high-interest vessels. Richard Clark has, he's the ex-terrorism czar, has talked extensively about his concerns with these ships being terrorist targets. And while we don't necessarily think that, a terrorist attack is likely in the Columbia River, the problem is what happens if, we go to Code Orange or Code Red and the Columbia River happens to have an LNG facility? This was the issue that essentially killed the proposal in Humboldt Bay. And that was a Calpine proposal. It's since moved right up to Astoria. The Humboldt fishermen got together, and they met with Calpine repeatedly. And what they decided was that under normal operation, they could probably deal with the proposal. And that's in a bay that's probably much more suitable to this kind of shipping than all the way up the Columbia River. But they said that under the scenario when there was some type of problem and there was increased security, they wouldn't be able to get to their fishing grounds.
No, and it could go on for a while, too. Is the Port Authority in Astoria, do they have jurisdiction over the shipping lanes at Bradwood? Have they weighed in on...
The ports of Vancouver.
What is their point of view?
Yeah, the ports of Vancouver and Kalama have been concerned enough to intervene. The Port of Portland did not intervene, which surprised us because of the...
What was their response? What was the Port of Portland?
They've been sort of silent so far, and I think they're waiting to see what shakes out. They may file to intervene later if these issues become very serious. The Coast Guard is considering this issue. One of the problems is that this really isn't a matter of set regulation or law. But it's hard to imagine any adequate security zone that wouldn't seriously impact traffic on the Columbia River. And the energy company, Northern Star, would like to say that's not going to be the case. But even a minor delay in one place or another could cause shippers to go different places. That's going to cause major economic impact right here in
the
Portland.
River. Yeah.
That's right.
It would shut down the river. These are busy shipping lanes, it's true. Another question I had, I was looking again at some of these websites, and there's a stark contrast between FERC's safety claims for these facilities and the history of them. BP, for one, has an absolutely shocking history of safety at these facilities. Could you talk a little bit about the gulf between the message coming from FERC and the message, and from also from the developers, and from the actual historical record?
Well, I think there's two different parts. I mean, the liquefied natural gas industry, a lot of experts agree that it has a decent safety record. I think that the problem is that when there are accidents, like happened in Algeria, in Skikda, Algeria, or in Nigeria, the accidents are so spectacularly large, or have the potential to be so large, that they're extremely low probability but very, very high impact events. FERC is, I think, just basically misleading the public. At their meetings, they're fond of saying LNG is not flammable, which is technically true, but of course neither is diesel fuel. You can stick a match straight into diesel fuel and it doesn't burn. And so this is the kind of information that they like to, you know, they'd like to show LNG, like show people drinking it or splashing it on, you know, splashing it around. And it's just absurd type of sort of dog and pony show that they bring in. And it's really misleading. And the other part of this that's really been poorly publicized and considered is the impacts of the pipeline, which is a major safety issue for people who live along it. It's going to be nearly 1,000 pounds per square inch, 1,000 PSI, which is really high pressure, and it's going to be non-odorized gas for 30-some-odd miles before it hits the main pipeline that runs down the I-5. And so there's a lot of safety issues, both with the vessels and with the pipeline. And so, you know, obviously if it's non-odorized, if there's a leak somewhere along that pipeline in this very complex terrain and these many river crossings, we're not going to know. The public won't know. And if it finds an ignition source at that kind of pressure, with the huge volumes of gas, a billion cubic feet per day moving out of that facility, there's the potential for some very big problems.
So it's going to go through, it's planned, if there were to be a terminal at Bradwood, the pipeline would go from Bradwood, 30 miles approximately, through rocky, heavily wooded terrain. I went out there and took a look, actually.
Yeah.
And then it's going to have to meet up with a major, huge pipeline along the I-5.
That's right.
Corridor.
That's right. That's the current plan. And there's other pipelines kind of in the works.
What kind of issues of? I know that with other sorts of pipelines, turbulence is an engineering puzzle and a problem that frequently results in oil spills. Are there issues of turbulence in these pipelines?
I think one of the big issues is the quality of their directional drills. I mean, if you get into the real technical stuff, they're going to drill under the Columbia River. And I don't know if you're familiar with what happened in Coos County when they did their pipeline there. They did multiple stream crossings and directional drills, and they had what's called frack outs, where for some reason the drill, instead of going horizontally, kind of bucks up through the base of the river and causes an explosion of bentonite clay, not explosion, but a plume of bentonite clay into the water body. And that's a major danger. And some of the streams they're crossing, they're going to trench openly. And that's one of the reasons that their biological assessment shows that they will have a significant adverse impact on salmon, is this issue of their stream crossings and the pipeline.
Not to mention the water table, the aquifer. How do these things affect the aquifer? That should be another concern, I would imagine.
And that's a major, major concern for landowners in the area who are becoming very organized and very very mobilized on this issue because, you know, it crosses their wells. You know, they've made very minimal requests, really, in some places of saying, well, you have to assure me that you will pay me if there's some problem with my well. And the pipeline company simply wouldn't do it up front. And so the landowner denied access to their property. And that's an experience that's being replicated all along the pipeline. And the arrogance of Northern Star is something that is really putting people off. And the same is true in Southern Oregon along the Pacific Connector, where that pipeline is it's just a catastrophe. I mean, the proposal is 223 miles straight to the California border. And that's very, very offensive to people who live in Southern Oregon to be used essentially as an energy colony of California. And this, it's exactly what's going on in Mexico. There are pipelines and LNG facilities being proposed in Baja that also feed the beast in the West Coast, which is California, which uses the lion's share of our natural gas that's on the West Coast.
So the Governor Schwarzenegger can maintain his green credentials.
That's right. That's right.
And movie stars can turn out in Malibu to protest. They had talked about, correct me if I'm wrong, talk a little bit, if you would, about the Malibu facility. Was it a floating LNG facility?
It is. It's offshore. Yeah. It's several miles offshore, and it is still causing, what's amazing is the intensity of the opposition to that facility. I mean, Southern California has a lot of offshore, rigs and things that are built, and they're unpopular, and they do a lot of damage. And one of the major concerns of that facility is the air quality impacts. And these are relatively, by fossil fuel standards, clean burning. But even, the industry loves to say that natural gas or methane is clean burning. But, it's not that clean burning. It's not clean burning enough to make a place like Southern California want it, that already has major air quality impacts. And so that's going to blow directly onshore. And, that's an issue with the lower Columbia as well. If you import a billion cubic feet of gas, and let's say you don't ship the gas to California and you decide to burn it and make electricity here in Oregon, well, electricity is going to go to California. Yeah. And all the air quality impacts of burning that fuel in Oregon will flush right down the Columbia, right into Portland. And, the Oregonian had a great article yesterday about benzene. I don't often laud the Oregonian too much, but there was. I mean, it's right on the front page. And the air quality in Portland is suffering already from burning fossil fuel. And the idea of increasing that, not only with an LNG terminal, but with all the development that it would probably bring behind it in terms of producing energy in a usable form, that's a serious consideration. And the industrialization of the lower Columbia is the issue here. And that has an impact on Portland, on the gorge, on the health of people all across, the Northwest.
When the costs of building these things are taken into account, I'm looking, let's see, we've got a few more minutes, but I really would like to talk about the costs associated both in purely financial terms and also in human terms. Mm-hmm. Because these are very high risk. The jobs that these things provide, if I understand it correctly, are somewhat high risk, and there are certain health concerns. Could you talk a bit about that, aspects, quality of life issues, that sort of thing?
I think that the idea that this is going to produce a whole bunch of jobs is a real red herring. I think there's construction jobs, and so, yeah, there's pipe fitting and pile driving and that kind of stuff needs to happen. But as far as operating these facilities, they have relatively few jobs, 50, compared to the economic impact of the fishing industry, let's say, in the Columbia River.
But what about the tourism industry?
Exactly. Both those would absolutely dwarf the amount of payroll that would come out of an LNG facility. And then you make another good point. I mean, if you're going to be employed as a security guard, which is probably the only kinds of jobs that would be available to most people in the lower Columbia at one of these facilities, my first choice would not be for a facility that has the potential to melt steel a half mile away if there were to be an explosion, which is, and I'm not making that up, that's the Sandia National Laboratories that has issued that statement. Security zones for these facilities are the impact zones are very, very large.
So talk a little bit more about that. It's just the pictures of what happened in Cleveland in 1944 are really, they're jaw-droppers. And I wonder if people have a really clear idea of what some of the things are. I mean, you say, you talk a bit about it, it's capable of melting steel. What sort of temperatures? Suppose one of these things, and to me, this facility, I'm looking at a picture of it, is absolutely enormous. It covers a huge huge area. What could be expected to happen? Are there easy ways to evacuate people in the event of an emergency?
That is a great question, and I think that what you've nailed there is one of the key FERC issues I have here, which is that FERC has got a mixed up order in how it considers these proposals. These safety issues are there is some disagreement about how what the level of risk is, but there's really very little disagreement that it's very, very large. It's like on par with a nuclear facility. It's huge. And who's paying for that risk is a major question. Right now, there's no risk on the Lower Columbia of an LNG explosion and fire or a pipeline explosion and fire in that area. And the cost is being borne by people who live there, and the risk is being taken on by people who live there, not these energy companies. What FERC has done is they said, well, you can have a preliminary safety and emergency response plan, but it doesn't have to be completed until 60 days before construction begins. That's after approval, permit approval. It's completely putting the cart before the horse in terms of how these facilities are being permitted. And I think we simply lack confidence that FERC is taking these safety issues into account and taking public involvement into account in a way. I mean, if you live half a mile from this facility and it gets approved, you have to be a participant in keeping the area safe. And the fact that the roads are shoddy, prone to slides, and narrow, and there are people who live on an island right across from it. I mean, those are people who live within a half mile or on an island. There's one way in and one way out.
And on that note, I'm going to invite you to come back again.
Thank you very much.
And we will hopefully at some point we'll be able to have enough time to invite listeners to call in and ask Dan questions. We've in the past talked a little bit about warming of the river, what the impact of the actual ships would be. This time we've talked about a little bit about safety issues, and in the future hopefully we will get to the issues of property rights and economic impact. This is a very, very serious matter. It's something that activists, people who consider themselves responsible stewards of Cascadia and who really love the environment, care deeply about it. This is an issue that we have to keep a very, very close eye on, because the dangers of the LNG terminals being located in our state, I'm not wishing to sound NIMBY about it, but really they ought not to be located anywhere. So that's what we've been doing today. We've been talking with Dan Sears, and my name is Chris Andre. I'm in for Scott Forrester for Monday on the Environment. Our engineer is Steve. And anything that you'd like to just say briefly in closing about this?
Yeah.
What can we do to help? What can we do?
There's a lot to be done still, and part of it is putting pressure on decision makers here in Oregon. Oregon, this, as a state, has permitting authority over many parts of these projects, and we can influence that. And part of it is raising awareness, not only about these issues here in the Columbia, but about the upstream issues.
Want to give a website where listeners can find out more and find out what they can do to get involved?
ColumbiaRiverVision.org is very good.
ColumbiaRiverVision.org, and we'll have all that information up at the front desk if you need to call in. Once again, thank you so much for listening. This is Chris Andre and for Scott Forrester from Monday on the Environment. You're listening to KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. It is 11 a.m. in the morning, and I thank you very, very much for listening.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946, with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212 in Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or radiocab.net. And now for Democracy Now!
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Brad Will!
Presente!
Emilio Alfonso Fabian!
Presente!
Mourners gather outside the Mexican consulate in New York to pay tribute to journalist and activist Brad Will. He was shot dead in Oaxaca, Mexico, Friday. He died with his camera in his hands. We'll go to Oaxaca, where thousands of federal police have been deployed to crush the popular uprising. and we'll remember Brad Will with those who knew him best.
Brad was just completely full of heart and courage. He was a big risk taker. He always did the riskiest part of any action. But unlike a lot of people who are intense that way, he did it out of love, not out of ideology.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the Mexican city of Oaxaca, thousands of federal police backed with armored vehicles and helicopters have raided the southern city in an attempt to crush the popular uprising in the region. Federal police have reportedly seized control of the city square. At least two protesters died last night, including a 15-year-old boy. On Friday, gunmen with ties to the government shot and killed three other people, including the U.S. journalist and activist Brad Will. Five men connected to Will's shooting have been turned over to state authorities. The suspected gunmen have been identified as two members of local city hall, two police officers, and the former justice of the peace of a nearby town. Brad Will was filming on his video camera when he was shot in the stomach. The sound of the shooting was captured on his camera. A protest is scheduled outside the Mexican consulate in New York today at 9. We'll have more on Oaxaca and the death of Brad Will in a few minutes. In Iraq, the U.S. death toll for the month has topped 100. October has been the deadliest month of the year for U.S. troops. In Baghdad, at least 30 Iraqis have died after a large bomb exploded earlier today in the Shia district of Sadr City. The bombing occurred even though Sadr City has been under a U.S. siege for the past 5 days. In Basra, gunmen killed 15 Iraqi police instructors and two translators Sunday. Overall, at least 83 Iraqis died yesterday. Meanwhile, on Saturday, a U.S. airstrike in the city of Ramadi killed six Iraqis, including three women and two children. Local residents condemned the attack.
U.S. forces demolished this house. We came in the morning and we found three dead civilians and three others were still missing.
A new U.S. government report has determined the military has failed to track hundreds of thousands of weapons intended for the Iraqi security forces. The Pentagon failed to even record the serial numbers of weapons given to the Iraqi military. In addition, the report found the Pentagon has failed to provide spare parts or repair manuals for most of the weapons. Meanwhile, the Army's admitted it's given out wrong or misleading information to the families of seven soldiers killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. One of the soldiers was the former football star Pat Tillman. He died in Afghanistan after being shot by a fellow Army Ranger, but the military told the family he died from enemy fire. The Army also admitted misleading the family of Sergeant Patrick McCaffrey. McCaffrey's mother, Nadja, formed Gold Star Families for Peace with Cindy Sheehan. Patrick was killed by an Iraqi soldier being trained by U.S. troops. In Brazil, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has been reelected by a landslide margin. Lula received about 61% of the vote. The former union leader proclaimed he'd remain a champion of Brazil's poor and workers.
We will continue to govern Brazil for everyone, but we will continue to give the most attention to those who need it most. The poor will have preference in our government.
Meanwhile, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, votes are being counted in that country's historic election between President Joseph Kabila and Jean-Pierre Bemba. It is being hailed as the country's first free election in more than 40 years. Election results are not expected for weeks. British journalist Robert Fisk is reporting Israel may have dropped uranium-based munitions on targets during its war against Lebanon. A leading British scientist has found soil samples in Lebanon show elevated radiation and the concentration of uranium isotopes. According to the scientist, Dr. Chris Busby, there are two possible reasons for the contamination. Israel might have dropped a small experimental nuclear fission device, or Israel used a bunker-busting conventional uranium bomb that employed enriched uranium. Robert Fisk reports a photograph of one explosion shows large clouds of black smoke that might result from burning uranium.
Israel's denied the report. However, last week, the Israeli military admitted for the first time it had dropped phosphorus bombs on Lebanon. In other news from Israel, the country's attorney general has said Israeli President Moshe Katsav should temporarily step aside while prosecutors decide whether to charge him with rape and other crimes. The United States has begun carrying out a naval exercise in the Persian Gulf near the coast of Iran. The U.S.-led war games are reportedly designed to test the ability of nations to intercept ships carrying weapons of mass destruction. The exercises are being conducted in the waters off Bahrain. The ships will be within 120 miles of the Iranian coast. Iran called the naval exercise adventurous. In Chile, a federal judge has ordered the arrest of former dictator Augusto Pinochet for carrying out 36 cases of kidnappings and 23 cases of torture at a secret prison. The prosecuting attorney, Hernan Quezada, praised the decision.
Because we're talking about crimes of torture, and those are crimes against humanity, with this resolution by Judge Solis, our country rises to the level of international law on this.
Student protesters at this country's premier school for the deaf are proclaiming victory after the Board of Trustees voted to terminate the appointment of the incoming school president. Gallaudet University had been the scene of several student and faculty protests over the hiring of Jane Fernandez to head the school. In recent weeks, student protesters had taken over school buildings and staged a three-day blockade of the campus. More than 130 students were arrested in the protests. And a former top Bush administration official has been sentenced to 18 months in prison for lying to federal investigators about his ties to Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff. The official, David Safavian, served as the Bush administration's chief procurement official. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to Oaxaca, where Mexican President Vicente Fox has sent in thousands of federal police to crush the popular uprising. Last night, police stormed the city with armored vehicles, helicopters, and water cannons. The police seized control of the city square. Over the past 5 months, the residents of Oaxaca, sparked by a teacher strike, had turned the city into an autonomous zone. The police and official government had been kicked out. In its place, the protesters formed the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca, or APO. For months, entire families have been camping outside to oversee barricades protecting the city. The protesters have been demanding the resignation of the state's governor, Ulises Ruiz, and the formation of a more representative government. But in recent weeks, the authorities have used increasingly violent tactics to crush the largely nonviolent movement. On Friday, gunmen linked to the government shot dead the New York indie media journalist and activist Brad Will, as well as a local teacher named Emilio Alfonso Fabian and a demonstrator named Esteban Zurita. Two more protesters were shot dead Sunday. We'll talk more about Brad Will's life in the program, but first we go to Oaxaca to speak with Gustavo Esteva. He is the founder of the Universidad de la Tierra in Oaxaca and author of many books, including Grassroots, Postmodernism, Remaking the Soil of Culture. Gustavo is also a columnist for La Jornada. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning. Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about the latest news right now out of Oaxaca, the storming of the city square by the federal police?
Well, basically, we have at least three persons dead. We have also lots of injured, people disappeared, many people in jail, and they are transporting them to the military zone, involving the army in this illegally. And we have reports that some of them are being tortured. And the police is occupying several points in the city. What was most impressive yesterday, it was the amazing self-restraint of thousands of people. They took the decision of not confronting the police and abandoning the area for the police to occupy it. But then immediately after that, surrounding the police. And then you have, yes, the police is occupying this critical strategical point, but the people are surrounding them. They are not in control of the city. The people are still in control of the city, of our lives. not confronting, using nonviolence. I don't know for how long we will be able to control the rage of the people, to have this self-restraint. Yesterday you could see many adults controlling the rage of the young people that wanted to attack. These are people that are have been humiliated, offended, attacked, and oppressed, and they have a lot of anger. But still they controlled their anger and decided to use nonviolence. But we don't know for how long we will be able to control the young people that are ready to confront the police and start the more violence.
Gustavo, I want to play for you part of one of the last interviews that Brad Will conducted before his death. It was with a female protester in Oaxaca. We don't know her name, but the footage was found on Brad's last videotape.
Esa camioneta que está ahí, se bajaron.
From the pickup you see over there, two men got out, gun in hand, and started shooting at us. From that pickup over there, they went there. Then they started attacking us. That's why all the people came outside to defend us.
Por eso salió toda la gente a defendernos.
This morning, one of our comrades was kidnapped. He was taken by three men, and he hasn't been found yet. That's why they burned that pickup. These guys are the priestas, members of the PRI, from the Municipal Party of San Marie, Ipotel, and are paid for by the PRI. They're paid 300 pesos a day to come and beat us up. As you can see, we're not teachers here. We're just people. We are people here, not teachers. We're people, not teachers. We're just people. The people fighting for our rights. We don't want to live like this anymore. We don't want to live in a constant state of repression, of blackmail, of murder, and shabby deals.
Queremos vivir en un estado de represión, de chantajes, de asesinatos, de tranzas. Ya no queremos vivir.
When Ulysses leaves Oaxaca, at that moment we will have peace. If he does not leave, we are not going to leave Oaxaca.
Oaxaca, créame, no se vale. Y por eso están enojados.
Unido jamás será vencido. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido.
Gustavo, can you respond to what this protester said?
Yes. This woman is expressing exactly the very nature of our movement. It's basically democracy now. And of course, we can specify what kind of democracy we are looking for. Of course, we want a formal democracy. We want cleaner elections. We want legitimate representatives, not an illegitimate governor as Ulysses Ruiz or an illegitimate president as Felipe Calderón. We want also participatory democracy, that is the involvement of the citizens in the decisions, including referendum and recall and all these tools for direct democracy. But we also want radical democracy, what we have in our municipalities, in our communities, when the people themselves, through assemblies, they can take decisions about their lives. We want democracy now, and this is a peaceful, democratic uprising of the people, trying to follow all the lines of the paths of the law or the institutions, trying to respect the law and the institutions, trying to be non-violent, and attacked by the police, attacked by these people. This woman was showing what we had in photos and videos, what Brad was having in the video of Brad, the last video of Brad, is showing the killers. And the killers, we have the faces, we have the names, we have identified everyone. It is people of the police, people of the respecting following instructions of Ulysses. This is a governor launching guerrilla attacks against the unarmed people. This is the kind of situation in which we are here.
Indie media journalist Brad Will had been covering the situation in Oaxaca for 4 weeks. In his last dispatch from Oaxaca, he wrote about a demonstrator named Alejandro Garcia Hernandez, who was killed on the barricades. Brad wrote, quote, "One more death, one more martyr in a dirty war, one more time to cry and hurt, one more time to know power and its ugly head, one more bullet cracks the night." Well, on Friday, Brad Will died at those same barricades. He had his video camera in his hand. His camera kept recording even after he was shot.
Ayúdame.
Brad Will died as he was being taken to the hospital. He was 36 years old. The Mexican daily El Universal has published photos of the alleged executioners. On Saturday, the mayor of Santa Lucia del Camino, Manuel Martinez Faria, said five men had been turned over to state authorities for possible involvement in the killing. He identified them as two members of the local city hall, two municipal police officers, and the former justice of the peace of a nearby town. Reporters Without Borders said it was deeply shocked over the killing of Brad Will. The organization called for Oaxaca Governor Ulises Ruiz to be summoned before the new prosecutor's office dealing with attacks on press freedom. It also urged federal authorities to investigate Ortiz and the Oaxaca Municipal Police. John Gibler as well joins us on the phone from Oaxaca, an independent journalist who knew Brad Will. John Gibler, can you talk about Brad?
I met Brad in Chiapas when the Zapatistas' other campaign began last January. We traveled together with a number of other people for about a month as we were filming, or he was filming. I was mainly conducting interviews and writing for ZNet about the people, the everyday people who were coming out to join the Zapatistas' movement there. And then I saw him in the streets about a month ago here in Oaxaca for the first time since then, and we went off to get coffee and talk about what was going on. He said he'd been trying to get here more or less since the state police came in the June 14th crackdown. It had taken him time to work up enough money to come down here and take time off work. And that he was most interested in filming interviews with just the everyday people and the people that he thought their voices would slip through the cracks and international media coverage and not get out to the people that he was hoping would be paying attention to what was happening here in Oaxaca. At first, he was saying he was really nervous. He didn't want to walk around to the barricades at night until he kind of got a feel for the town, which I thought was definitely very wise, and spent a couple of weeks just going out and hitting all the barricades, all the protest encampments, and conducting hours and hours of interviews with people. I saw him in several of the mobile brigades where we joined the people who would commandeer city buses and go around to spray paint government offices. And he was definitely fearless once he'd gotten a feeling for the town and just going wherever the action was. But he was also, he was also being smart. He was hanging out with all the national and the local press corps here who know the scene pretty well, but you can only be so smart when paramilitaries jump out of houses with machine guns.
Hmm. Gustavo Esteva, you also knew Brad Will. You also, in addition to founding the University of the Land in Oaxaca, are a columnist for La Jornada, the Mexican newspaper.
Yes. He was coming to our office. We were collaborating with Indy Media. And he was fantastic. He was, I liked the guy a lot. He had a peculiar genius for reporting, and he was, of course, very courageous. Yes, he was prudent, as was just mentioned, but he was very courageous. He had no limits on his activity with the people. He shared this element of being unarmed and doing his things and being attacked by these people. Yes, he had a peculiar genius for reporting.
We're going to go to break, and when we come back, we'll continue this discussion and also the extended struggle, why the teachers originally went out on strike 5 months ago. We're talking to Gustavo Esteva. He's a columnist for La Jornada. We're also speaking with John Gibler. He is a U.S. journalist who is based in Oaxaca. Like Brad Will, who was killed on Friday at one of the barricades, shot by men who have been identified and apparently have been taken into custody. The break today is Brad Will singing.
KBOO needs your help today to help mail out our monthly listener guide. Come on down to the station at 20 Southeast 8th anytime today to help us mail out the listener's guide. Thank you very much.
singing Hope at the Moore Gardens benefit at Angel Arensons here in New York. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Federal police have laid siege to the city square in Oaxaca as of last night. We're talking today also about one of the people who were killed over the weekend. It's believed six people were killed. Our guests are Gustavo Esteva, columnist for La Jornada, as well as John Gibler, a U.S.-based journalist who is in Oaxaca right now and has been reporting for us. Gustavo, can you go back and talk about why the teachers went on strike 5 months ago? What is the significance of this uprising that has taken place?
Well, the question was that the teachers started their strike. As usual, every year they are forced to do this kind of strike to get some improvement in the terrible conditions, terrible economic conditions. But that was not something special. That was the usual thing. But then after 3 weeks of their strike in June 14th, they suffered a terrible, stupid, barbaric repression by the police of Ulises Ruiz, the governor. And that was the detonator of the movement. People started to react immediately, joining, supporting, expressing solidarity with the teachers and expressing the decision to oust the governor. And then this was the detonator of the accumulated discontent of the whole state. After that, 5 days later, we have APO, the creation of this assembly of the peoples of Oaxaca. We have a march of almost a million people, that is a third of the population of the state. We have every kind of activities after that, that was the consolidation, the expression of a very well-organized discontent of the people. This is a movement without leaders, in which the people themselves, very well-organized, with amazing courage and amazing capacity of expressing their will, they are organized first to oust this governor and then to change our society, to create a different kind of society. We don't want anymore this kind, as the woman said, we don't want anymore this kind of repression, of corrupt government, of imposition, of authoritarianism, and we want a different kind of conviviality in our lives.
It's interesting, Gustavo, that you said that, in fact, the federal police don't have control of the city, whether or not they've taken the city square. It's certainly not what's being reported in the U.S. press. The reports are that Vicente Fox, as a result of an American journalist being killed and others, moved in thousands of federal police to restore order to Oaxaca, and they have taken the city.
Well, the disorder has not been created by the people. It has been created by this barbaric, psychopathic governor, using hired killers and using the structures of authority that should protect the law to violate the law. It is not the people themselves who have created disorder in the city. That is the alibi of President Fox, using the police to support this governor in a very peculiar structure of cynicism and complicity. It is a combination that is forcing the people of Oaxaca to pay a very heavy price for a democratic, peaceful struggle. And I cannot avoid but remembering it was Napoleon, they say, who said that marionettes can be used for many things except to sit on them. You cannot govern or control the city with the police. The police, yes, can kill us. The police can come and occupy with all their weapons, with all their tanks. They can occupy one plaza. They can occupy one specific point. But they cannot control the city. They cannot govern the city. They cannot govern our lives and our conscience. We are in control of the city and in control of our lives. And we will surround this police with our bare hands, and we will still control our lives, not the police.
John Gibler, this report of the five men that have been taken and that Gustavo also commented on Saturday, the mayor of Santa Lucia del Camino said five men have been turned over to state authorities for the killing, identified as two members of local city hall, two municipal police officers, the former justice of the peace of a nearby town. Just before Brad Will was killed, you did a piece on paramilitaries and death squads. Can you talk about them?
Absolutely. It's really important to remember, and this kind of reinforces Gustavo's point about who creates disorder in Oaxaca. Since August, paramilitary groups who have been identified in photographs have been driving through the city killing protesters at barricades, and they've been doing this with total impunity. So the fact that they've claimed to have apprehended and turned over to authorities the five gunmen who were killing people on Friday is of little consolation, since they've had these people identified for months, and the very authorities themselves have taken steps back to actually trying to enforce the law and bring the gunmen to any kind of justice. Both the government and most of the press, especially the international press, has made much more of a fuss about protesters wearing bandanas and spray painting pretty buildings than they have about paramilitary death squads who have been driving around town with total impunity, killing people for months.
I wanted to turn now to the response in New York to Brad Will being killed. And also I want to let our radio listeners know that we are broadcasting this on television, of course, as we do every day, and all of the video here is available online at democracynow.org. But in New York, demonstrators gathering outside the Mexican consulate this morning at 9 a.m. to protest the murder of Brad Will and the killing of other peaceful protesters in Oaxaca. Brad Will was a well-known and much-loved activist and journalist in New York and around the world. He was involved in countless struggles over the past decade. Many in New York remember him standing on the roof of a squat on Fifth Street in Manhattan, just as New York was trying to demolish the building. The scene was captured in a documentary made by Paper Tiger Television. Brad would later play a key role in trying to protect the city's community gardens. He hosted his own radio show on the pioneering micro radio station Steal This Radio. For years, he was involved in the indie media network in New York as well as in Latin America. He spent much of the past few years documenting the people's movements in Brazil, Bolivia, Ecuador, Argentina, most recently Mexico. On Saturday night, an emergency rally was held outside the Mexican consulate in New York. Speakers included longtime New York activist Becca Economopoulos.
Friend Brad Will was murdered by government-backed paramilitary forces in Oaxaca, Mexico. Now, Brad's death is being used as a pretext by the government and the media to send in more of those same troops. Brad was there to support and document the resistance of teachers and other civilians. We demand that his death not be used as an excuse to increase the oppression and violence against the people of Oaxaca by government forces. In solidarity with the people of Oaxaca, we demand that the federal government negotiate directly with people on the barricades in Oaxaca, remove all armed forces acting on behalf of the government against the people, the immediate removal of the illegitimate Governor Ruiz, all guilty parties at all levels be identified and held accountable for the assassination of Brad Will and other civilian victims in Oaxaca. Yeah. We make these demands in support of the Oaxacan people's efforts to establish a new autonomous popular government that recognizes local traditions and values.
That was Becca Economopoulos. Brandon Jordan of the New York City Independent Media Center also spoke outside the Mexican consulate.
Brad Will went to Oaxaca because he was a firm believer in direct democracy. He went there to document what was happening amongst people there who were trying to create a system of direct democracy. He died doing what he loved. He died with his passion at creating, doing media activism and creating a radical alternative to the corporate media. The Independent Media Center is a network of over 160 independent media centers worldwide. This developed out of the movement against corporate globalization in 1999 in Seattle. Brad was a volunteer from the very beginning. Brad was close to all of us. He'll be missed. He was a wonderful, gentle, beautiful person.
Indie media journalist Brandon Jordan outside the Mexican consulate. We're joined by Diane Neary now in our Firehouse studio. She was a close friend of Brad's. Together, they traveled extensively through Latin America to help build indie media centers. Leslie Kaufman is also with us. She's a longtime New York activist, a friend of Brad's. Welcome both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Diane, you just flew in from Hawaii. Mm-hmm. How did you hear about Brad's death?
I was sitting alone in a park in Hilo, Hawaii, in the Big Island, where I've been living for the last couple months. And I got a phone call from someone named Kenick, someone I don't even know. And he was at a critical mass in New York, and it was all loud behind him. And I'm like, what's this about? And he told me that Brad had been hurt and that he wanted me to get in touch with his mother. And I said, how hurt? You know, I want to be able to tell her what's going on. And so he told me to call someone named Jacob, who I also didn't know, and Jacob thought that I did know. So he just said, oh, yeah, it's been confirmed. Brad's been shot in the chest and he's dead. And I was like, I just crumpled and fell, and I couldn't move or talk or breathe or any normal human functions for hours. And I didn't believe it. And then everyone in the world was calling me, and I had to believe it. And really quick, just because this was really eerie, Brad was a musician. He sang a lot. He sang on Democracy Now! We used to sing songs together. I knew dozens of songs that he had taught me. I haven't sang these songs in a couple years because I always felt really self-conscious doing it without him. And that day in the park, half an hour before I found out, all of a sudden, randomly, I had this urge to sing as loud as I possibly could all these songs, and like 5-6 songs in a row that I remembered. All of a sudden, all the words were coming back to me, and I thought, wow, I gotta go write Brad, because he had just emailed me. And I'm like, oh, I gotta go write to him and let him know that for the first time in a couple of years, I'm sitting here just singing these songs that he taught me. I don't know what that was.
Did he email you from Oaxaca?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What did he tell you about what was happening there?
He told me that he was a little scared, that it was like a turning point, that this was a people's revolt, that it was a crucible, that it was inspiring to him, but that things were getting sketchy, and that he didn't even know if he was up for it, but he knew that he had to be. Brad was always putting himself in the firing line, you know, whether or not, I mean, he knew in the back of his mind, you know, we always knew when things were dangerous, but for him, that was secondary to getting the story out and being an observer and being there and struggling and fighting and being there to bear witness to things that weren't going to otherwise make news media and documenting this, like, very human struggles.
Leslie Kaufman, how did you meet Brad Will?
I met Brad during the fight to save the Chico Mendez mural garden in the Lower East Side, which was ultimately bulldozed in early 98. Brad not only participated in the movement to save the gardens, he really transformed it. He had been on the West Coast working with Earth First. He had been at Redwood Summer at the headwaters and was working to save the old growth forest there. And he came back to New York, and he brought a whole series of tactics borrowed from Earth First, which really changed the face of the garden movement, the notion of doing lockdowns and various kinds of ways of doing barricades in order to hold land as part of a nonviolent struggle. But he also brought a utopian vision where, you know, Brad would talk about a garden as a temporary autonomous zone, not just a plot of land, not just a respite from the city, but as a place to build a model of a different kind of life and a different kind of society. And those two things had tremendous influence on the movement to save community gardens, which Brad stayed involved in for years.
And then his travels through Latin America. Diane, you went to some of these places with Brad Will.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Where?
We went to Argentina, Ecuador, Bolivia, Peru, and Brazil. We spent about 3.5 months in Ecuador and a few months in Argentina and Brazil, and then we passed through other places, but that's where we spend a lot of our time in various projects.
Since Friday, hundreds of activists from around the world have paid tribute to Brad Will. Many have posted their memories on the New York City Indie Media website. On Sunday, we reached one indie media activist in Brazil named Toya, who worked closely with Brad.
Met him. He was coming from a long trip around the coast of, like, South America. He went to Ecuador and came all down the coast, you know, like, he and his companion, Diane, at the time, they were carrying, like, heavy, heavy backpacks full of, like, equipment that they collected around the United States. And so they would stop every country, like, they stopped at Peru, they stopped at Bolivia, and get together with the social movements in there and other anarchist collectives, indie media collectives, and share those equipments and also knowledge.
Toya in Brazil. Do you know her, Diane?
Yeah, Toya was a friend of ours. It's good to hear her voice again. I haven't spoken to her since this, but I've been meaning to get in touch with her.
And Brad's mission in Latin America, the reason he went to Bolivia, Ecuador, Brazil, Mexico?
Well, I think that he saw a spirit there that didn't exist here. I think we ultimately talked about maybe moving down there for good, you know, like and afterwards I realized, like, he's a traveler. He just always wanted to be where the action was. He really did. He wanted to be a part of that spirit so that it filled him, and it just seemed like everywhere we went, he would always say, like, oh, the United States, we don't even have a culture. But here, like, their culture is so much music and food and dancing and just spirit of people. They have, everywhere that the things that we seem to be a part of, there's a lot of, like, revolutionary spirit intrinsic to people, because when you're oppressed on a daily basis, it's naturally, like, the natural reaction is to rebel. And he respected that. And honored it, and just felt like it was necessary. And that when if that's where all the action was going to be, then feeling that, then he wanted to be a part of it, you know. And he wanted to tell those stories and be a part of those struggles. And I don't know, when we first went down to Brazil for the first time, we were in Fortaleza. It was the Inter-American Development Bank conference, and he said, "Oh, there's going to be this big protest. I want to help plan actions, and I want to help people," because they were asking for people to, like, help with mobilization type stuff who had experience, and he just want, and not to, like, teach people how to protest, but just kind of to be a part of that. And what we saw, and I think this was so glaring, was, for instance, they were pushing people out of their own communities. There were internet cafes, coffee shops, restaurants where the locals couldn't even go. They said, this whole zone is reserved for people who are part of this conference. And we were both floored. They're like, so you live here, but now you can't go. Like, these kids were saying that they were being kicked off their own beach so they could build a hotel. So they were, like, bulldozing all these houses that people had built with their own hands 20 years ago from these beaches in Fortaleza, Brazil, this beautiful tropical place, to make it a tourist resort. So also it's about, like, the earth and preserving these beautiful places throughout South America, many of which we visited, and just realizing they were going to become resorts or whatever it was.
Because Diane, Mary, and Leslie Kaufman, we're going to go to break, which is, again, Brad Will singing, and then we'll return, and we'll also continue talking with our guests in Oaxaca. Stay with us.
Listen, is a story that you may not understand, but the parking lots will crack and bloom again. There's a world beneath the pavement that will never end. Willie says, if you can hear the sound of birds, with a song above chaos, hear their words. Listen to their love song, it will never end. Sits with me above the city, while we watch the madness of the world below. tells me that it's temporary. Underneath the wild garden leads to grove. In a place where one can rarely smell the land, but the ocean breeze still blows here, it will never end. Will it
serve? Brad Will singing a Dana Lyons song. He's here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to some archival footage of Brad Will, this was recorded in the late 1990s at a time when he hosted a radio show on the pioneering micro radio station Steal This Radio.
I think for the FCC, micromedia that is non-commercial, anti-profit, community-based is poison to their program of supporting corporate control of the media. And what they are interested in is supporting the National Association of Broadcasting and their complete leveling of culture in the United States, their complete clear-cutting of American tastes and values, and trying to propagate through Congress, through elected officials, through lobbyists, through huge amounts of money being thrown into the media spectrum, their ability to control what people think. And that's really what's at stake, is the free flow of ideas in people's minds that is so much controlled by the media as we know it, and especially the mass media that has the public ear and that really dominates people's lives. You know, New York's a very isolating place in a lot of ways, and I think the Lower East Side is one of the few places that's actually still a community. And it's easy for people to kind of fall into that, go home, turn on the TV, and eat their dinner and try to survive mentality that, you know, takes so many people away from an awareness of what's really going on. And on a micro level, on a local level, a community level, you know, that there's a community space right down the block that's under threat. You know, Charis El Bohio has been sold by the city, you know, and it can be stopped, you know. And what people need to know is that it's possible, it's not over, you know, or that even if one garden falls, that there's still so many more to save, and that there's still a chance. And the concrete things is that people come up to me and talk to me about things they want to be heard on the radio, events that they want to propagate, and demonstrations that they want people to show up for. And you know, people come up to me and tell me about my show and are really appreciative, you know, about what I'm trying to do and what we're all trying to do. Save this neighborhood, save ourselves.
Brad Will is also remembered by many for his efforts to prevent New York City from demolishing a squat on the Lower East Side. When the city moved in to demolish the building on Fifth Street, he stood atop the roof waving his arms. Brad's efforts stalled the demolition, but the city eventually leveled the building, which housed a cafe, a meeting place, and a performance space. Brad later talked about the building in a program produced by Paper Tiger Television called ABC Survives Fifth Street Buried Alive.
We were making a home out of a crumbling building. You know, the interior of the building needed help, and we brought that building back to life. It was standing strong. And the only reason it was standing was because people were living in it. If we had let it go the way the city wanted it to go, they tore out the stairwell. They punched holes in the roof. The water, the rain was rotting that building from the inside out. We replaced the joists. We rebuilt the floors. We sheetrocked the walls and made that building alive. What did they do? They killed it. That building's over 100 years old. It was standing strong.
That was Brad Will as he was talking about the squats in New York. Leslie Kaufman, can you talk about these squats for people who have never even heard the term?
Well, they were abandoned buildings that had been just standing vacant for years and years all over the city, but there was a particularly strong movement to rehabilitate these buildings in the Lower East Side. And really, they were homesteaders. I mean, it's a long-standing, you know, all-American tradition. They took over these abandoned properties and they fixed them up and created spaces for people to live who had nowhere to live. And much as those who created the community gardens in New York City were homesteaders, too. They took over abandoned lots and cleared them of bottles and used needles and all the garbage that was there and turned them into spaces of beauty and hope. And Brad so much believed in creating that kind of hope and beauty in the world, and found himself in conflict with the authorities over and over again because, for example, the city of New York wouldn't let that stand, wouldn't let the squats continue, wouldn't let homesteaders get the deed to their own place, wouldn't let the community gardens flourish.
I wanted to go back to Gustavo Estevo in Oaxaca, the columnist for La Jornada. You knew Brad, and I was wondering the significance of having U.S. journalists and activists come down to Oaxaca. How do you see it?
He was in our office a week ago, and you have been listening to some examples of Brad's passion for life and beauty. He had a genius to discover where the life was, where it was flourishing, and sharing his own passion with our passion for life. It is really one of the many paradoxes that he died in this search for life. It is also a paradox that he is now being used as a pretext for more killing and more oppression. His death is really used now by the authorities, saying that it is a justification. It is because of this kind of violence that they are bringing the police for more oppression and more aggression and more killings. Brad was with us just a few days ago in our office with our people working together. We have been involved in one of the activities of Indie Media, he was with us and with Vlad, that is one of our collaborators. He was very close to Vlad, and both Vlad and Brad were working together in this reporting. And of course, also Brad has this specific genius for reporting what was happening, what he was capturing, these living elements that he was discovering in the middle of the movement.
John Gibler, there is a protest planned for today in Oaxaca.
Correct. They've yesterday the Apple provisional leaders, and as well just the word that was running through the crowds on the street, was to pull back at night, to not fall into provocations, to not fall into violence, to take back the streets during the daytime today. As Gustavo mentioned, the control of the city depends how you define control. If it's presence of armor and automatic weapons, then the mainstream media might think that the police have control, but if it's the spirit of the people and the people taking to the streets even in the face of continued paramilitary attacks and a police invasion, then the people of Oaxaca strongly retain control of the city. I was greatly impressed yesterday by the numbers of people that came out to fill the barricades, and people from all walks of life, entire families, people holding their children, walking right up to the police to put flowers in their armor and then march with them instead of confronting them. And I think that the response today will be similar, that it will be thousands and thousands of people taking the streets to march and to stand in the barricades.
Gustavo Esteva, do you see Chiapas, do you see Oaxaca today as Chiapas, more than 10 years ago?
We are the same. We are Chiapas is still alive here in Oaxaca, and in a sense, we are a fruit of Chiapas. It was the awakening created by Chiapas. When in Chiapas 10 years ago, they said, basta, enough. We have enough of this system of this oppression. That was something that awakened us here in Oaxaca. We had, of course, our own long struggle, but Chiapas is here with us right now. It is, we are joining in the same kind of struggle for democracy now, for our definition of our own life. We want to define us, the Zapatistas said. This is exactly what we are saying today in Oaxaca. We want a world in which many worlds can be embraced. We want the harmonious coexistence of the difference. Perhaps Oaxaca movement today, it is one of the best expressions of one element, brilliant element of contemporary movements all over the world. That is the policy of one no, many yeses, in which in the past you have movements that will have one no and one yes, and saying an affirmation to something and denial to something. Here we have a no to something and accepting the plurality of yeses, the plurality of affirmations, the plurality of lives. Here in Oaxaca, you have, this is the only state in which the majority of the people are Indians, and they belong to 16 different indigenous cultures. Here we have the plurality, as it is also natural and cultural plurality, biodiversity. And you have this expression of a movement that is saying no to this government, or no to this oppression, no to this kind of political regime, no to this kind of economic organization, but we are accepting, we are not attached to any specific ideology or any specific leader or any specific organization. We have many yeses. We are accepting the plurality of our world, and we want to find ways for the harmonious coexistence of these different people.
Gustavo Esteva, we're going to turn now to a tribute to Brad Will from his friend and fellow musician, David Rovex.
Brad embodied the spirit of indie media. He was not just covering stories that the mainstream press ignores, such as the exciting, violent, revolutionary moment which has gripped Oaxaca for several months now. Brad was not risking his life to get a good shot at a confrontation, at a barricade, because he might get a photo on the cover of a newspaper, get some perhaps well-deserved fame and money. He was posting his communiques on indie media for free. Sure, Brad was filming in order to cover history, but he was there also to make history. Brad knew that a camera is a weapon, or hopefully a shield of some sort, and sometimes can serve to de-escalate a situation to protect people from being violated, beaten, killed. And Brad knew that if the independent media didn't document history, nobody else would. Brad deeply appreciated the power of music and culture. If he didn't have a camera in his hands, he often had a guitar. During some of his many travels around Latin America, he wrote emails to me about the musicians he met, with whom he shared my songs and recordings. He particularly liked my song St. Patrick Battalion and reportedly shared his rendition of it with lots of people. He would not live to know just how much his life and death would resemble the San Patricios, who died fighting for Mexico during the first U.S. invasion of that country in the 1840s. Through all Brad did and saw on large swaths of three different continents, he somehow continually brought with him a boundless enthusiasm and obvious love of life, love, a good party, a good riot. He was my favorite kind of person, my favorite kind of revolutionary, the sort who is just as comfortable talking about revolutionary theory, current events, music, relationships, or smoking a bowl on a Manhattan rooftop at sunset. The kind of person who is alive in mind, body, and spirit in equal proportions. Brad became a radical long before it was briefly fashionable in the U.S. with the WTO protests in Seattle, and long since it became unfashionable there, September 11, 2001. The kinds of tactics and politics that the global justice movement became briefly known for were practiced by people like Brad in the squatters movement in New York City and the radical environmental movement on the West Coast in the 90s. Brad was in both places and many more. Brad was somewhere near the ground floor of many other more recent anarchist institutions, Food Not Bombs, Critical Mass, Reclaim the Streets, Guerrilla Gardening, Indie Media. He saw the connections, deeply understood the concept of the commons, and went for it as an activist, a video journalist, a musician, and a cheerleader. There have been many debates about whether it is more useful to organize large events or to focus on community organizing locally. whether to focus on recording history or making it, whether to educate or to act, whether to have a party or have a meeting. Brad clearly decided that the correct answer is all of the above. The reality of this is easy to demonstrate. Talk to anybody in New York City involved with just about any aspect of the progressive movement. It's a city of 8 million people. But if they are serious participants in the more grassroots end of the movement, they know Brad. Though they may not have known his last name, he's just Brad, the tall, thin guy with long hair who is often flashing a warm, gentle smile with a compassionate, intelligent glint in his eye. He's often described with a connector like Brad from Indie Media or Brad from More Gardens or Brad the Musician. I haven't seen him in a while, several months at least, but suddenly I miss him so much. I miss hanging out with him in the Lower East Side, chilling at his place there, swapping stories. I miss the rejuvenating warmth of his presence. I miss the unspoken mutual admiration. I miss the feeling that I was in the presence of someone who so deeply felt his connection to the world. The feeling that here was somebody who would die for me and me for him, no questions asked. And now, like so many others before him, he's done just that. Like all of the rest of us, over the generations, his memory will fade and eventually disappear. But for those of us alive today who had the honor of being one of Brad's large circle of friends, his memory will be with us painfully, deeply, lovingly, until we all join him beneath the ground. Hopefully, only after each of us has managed to have the kind of impact on each other, on the movement, and the world that Brad surely had in his short 36 years.
David Rovics, musician remembering his fellow musician, also journalist and activist, Brad Will. Diane Neary, we end with you.
Wow, that was really hard to see, but it was really good to see his face and hear his voice again. I miss him to death. My life is forever changed. I mean, it was from the day I met him, but I've been thinking a lot about him in just the last few days, how much he's affected my life and how much it made me want to be a better, not just a better warrior, but a better human being, because he was such a good person and a good friend. I love you.
Diane, thanks so much for being so brave as to come on today. And Leslie Kaufman and our friends in Oaxaca, Gustavo Esteva and John Gibler. That does it for the show. Thank you to Elizabeth Press and Danielle Sternberg-Peschkin, Mike Burke. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is the KBOO Community Calendar for Monday, October 30th. Today you can join Portland Center Stage for a panel discussion exploring parallel themes in current and upcoming works by PCS, Readers Theater Repertory, and the Inside Out Theater Collective. The panel will discuss and engage the audience in issues of identity, the artist and civic responsibility, and the ethics of loyalty, as well as corollaries between the rising tide of fascism in the early 20th century and the specious currency of civil liberties in contemporary society. The event is free and open to the public, and refreshments will be served. It's from 6 to 8 p.m. and is located in the Studio Girding Theater at the Armory on 128 Northwest 11th Avenue. For more information, call Tim DeRoach at 503-445-3794. For a little fun today, you can go to the Multnomah County Library Midland Branch for a free Day of the Dead and Halloween activity night. You can see an exposition of authors and join in games and other fun accompanied by Mexican folk music. Wear a costume and join the costume parade. The event is from 5:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. and is located at the Multnomah County Library on 805 Southeast 122nd Avenue in Portland. For more information, contact 503-988-5392. You can come to the OMSI Science Pub today for a free discussion on the origins of life on Earth with Dr. Niles Lemon, Professor of Chemistry at Portland State University. Dr. Lemon will explore problems in studying the origins of life and will tell about some insights and advances towards solving the puzzle of the beginning of life on Earth. The discussion begins at 7 p.m. and is located at the Bridgeport Brew Pub and Bakery on 1313 Northwest Marshall in Portland. For more information, contact sciencepub at omsi.edu or visit www.omsi.edu. If you want to enhance your personal connection to the community and nature, You can join the weekly Naturalist Skills Community Night by Cascadia Wild today. At Naturalist Skills Community Night, folks get together and learn some aspects of fire, water, shelter, food, tracking, bird language, and more. These gatherings give everyone an opportunity to meet folks, learn stuff, and have a lot of fun. Everyone is welcome. The event is from 7 to 9 p.m. For more information, visit www.cascadiawild.org or call 503-235-9533. You have been listening to the KBOO Community Calendar for Monday, October 30th, 2006. This is KBOO Portland.